Kelly Krager conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Clark Kent. Today is 9 June 2015. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, on the campus of Texas Tech University, and Mr. Kent is joining me by telephone from his home on Bainbridge Island, Washington. Mr. Kent, to begin this interview, I'd like to get some biographical information from you, if I could. Let's start with when and where you were born.
Born in Shreveport, Louisiana, January 11th, 1946.
And what were your parents' names?
My father was Harold Kent, and my mother was Janice Kent.
And what did they do for a living?
My dad was in the oil business. He was primarily in the oil exploration business, owned a seismograph company, which ultimately was in Houston, Texas. And spent his whole career basically in the oil business.
I'll be darned. What about your mother?
She was a housekeeper.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Did you have any brothers or sisters?
I was an only child, and then 11 years later, there was twin brothers.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
That's really interesting. Huh. Now, did you grow up there in the Gulf area? Did you grow up in, you mentioned off the record a little bit ago that you grew up mostly in Houston, is that correct?
I grew up in Houston, yes.
Yeah. Tell me about growing up in Houston in the 1950s. What was Houston like? What was life like for you there?
Well, it's a normal childhood, I think. It was lived in a community called West University, and started elementary school there, and then we moved to a new development area in southwest Houston, Westbury. Went to junior high and senior high there, and had traditional growing up experience through hot and humid Houston, and did the Boy Scout, Cub Scouts, and all that type of thing. And then in high school, I was in the ROTC, and interested in the military, and played sports and whatnot. So just a normal childhood, nothing too extreme.
Yeah. What piqued your interest in the military?
I don't know. It was a combination. One of the things that came together, I had a, we'll still do, he's still 92 years old, an uncle that went to Annapolis and became a naval aviator. And he during the summers would invite me to wherever they were stationed throughout the country, and he was on squadron commanders and whatnot and carriers and so forth and so on, and took me to Annapolis. Actually wanted me to go there, but so he was I think probably the force. My dad was in World War II in the Navy, but he didn't make it a career or anything like my uncle.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. So both your father and your uncle served in the Second World War then?
Well, my uncle actually graduated from Annapolis just at the end of World War II, but ended up in Japan as part of the initial forces that went in there. It was in Hiroshima and so forth. So he got just the tail end of it, but not actual combat.
Yeah. Okay. And what did your father do in the Navy?
He was on a destroyer. He was a communications officer of some kind. He never really talked much about it.
Yeah. So was you think this was kind of a lot of the influence that encouraged you to get involved in the military?
Yeah, I think that had some part of it.
Yeah. Huh. Interesting. Well, tell me about school. You mentioned the Boy Scouts and some of the sports. What other sort of things did you like to do?
Well, just really a very traditional, normal childhood. Played sports in school. It was never very good, but just played sports. And, at that point in time, I think, you know, education in Texas, you learn more about Texas initially than you did the United States, and then after you had the Texas history, you became aware that we were part of the United States, and so I loved history and read a lot about history and so forth, and gravitated from Texas history to U.S. history and whatnot, but I did a lot of reading and loved history.
Now, with this kind of background, Mr. Kent, you're growing up here in the 1940s and the 1950s, obviously the 1960s, and the dominant global issue, the international community, is the Cold War. Mm-hmm. What do you remember about the Cold War growing up?
Well, it was a significant influence because it was the whole era during that time was definitely, it was on the front burner all the time, and I can remember in school having the air raid drills where you drop and get under your desk and so forth, and there was a constant threat hanging over it that, you know, somebody was going to attack somebody, and it was predominant, really. I mean, it was, or not predominant, but it was definitely a factor from elementary school on, and discussed every day, and then in the news and that type of thing. The Cuban Missile Crisis was, of course, very big. Everybody thought that was Armageddon, and so it was a definite influence.
Yeah. Now, speaking of the 1960s, when you're coming of age to a degree here, you're in your teenage years, going to high school. Of course, Kennedy is elected president in 1960. What are your memories of the Kennedy administration, of the man himself?
Well, my dad was a Republican, so I can remember I wasn't too thrilled. But John Kennedy, the whole Camelot thing and something really new to politics, I vividly remember, because he was different than the family, the Kennedy family and whatnot. And I think most people sense that, you know, this was something different, although in my circle of family and whatnot, they were definitely not in favor of what he was going to do. He was a left-wing liberal from Massachusetts, Catholic, so forth. So, but personally, as a kid, I was thinking that he was kind of refreshing and unique. But when he was killed, actually, they had bussed us over to Rice Stadium to hear him speak prior to that. And that's why I still remember that. And the whole, I can remember where I was when it was announced that he had been assassinated.
And where were you?
The whole weekend after that. Very vivid.
Yeah. Where were you when he was when you received?
I was in the lunchroom in high school.
Yeah. What was the reaction?
Well, they told everybody to go to their classrooms, and as I remember, I think it was over the loudspeaker system. They broadcast what was going on for a while, and everybody was more shocked. Everybody went home, and of course we were glued to the TV the rest of the time, and saw the whole weekend transpire, and then Ruby being killed in national TV, and then the funeral. So the whole nation, at least where I was, stopped for that period of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of those unique moments in history, of course.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're making your way through what you call a normal childhood here, growing up in the Houston area, going to school, doing the things that the kids are supposed to do. You have an interest in the military. You're going through ROTC. What are your thoughts about what you're going to do after high school? Are you considering going into the military for sure? Or are you looking at college? What was going through your mind?
No, I wanted to go to college, and my dad wanted me to go into oil business. It was up when I was 14, I got out of school one day, and the next day I was in the swamps in Louisiana on a geophysical crew, which was my dad's company. And, he wanted me to learn the business from the ground floor up, which I did, or the swamp floor. So every summer from that point forward, I'd work in oil fields or in geophysical work. And in high school, I worked offshore some. So I was learning the oil business, and I learned it. Didn't really want to do it. I was trying to figure out a graceful way to not do it, but I was going to go to college.
Did you have any inclination of where you wanted to go?
I went to Stephen F. Austin the first year.
Okay, why did you choose Stephen F.?
It was a combination of friends that were going up there, was away from home, mm-hmm. but not real far, and it was really a combination of friends, I think, that were going there.
Mm-hmm. And what were you going to study there?
History.
Okay. Now, when did you enter, I should ask you this, when did you enter Stephen F. Austin?
I graduated in 64, so it was the fall of 64.
Okay, so fall of 1964. Now, this is the time that, you know, Vietnam is beginning to become a little more well-known mm-hmm. in the United States. Obviously, things have been going there on with the United States for a number of years, and not just yes. Vietnam, but Laos, et cetera. How much did you know about what was going on in Vietnam there? Say,
I was
60?
Following it closely, and reading and watching the news. And like you say, it was escalating, and as time grew, it became more noticeable. And so I followed it and read and was keenly interested in it because it was, in my mind and a lot of others at the time, it was the good versus the bad, us versus the communists, and draw the line in the sand and the domino effect and all of that. So I had a lot of interest in it.
Yeah. Well, what was your, because you were so interested in this, what was your opinion of the way things were shaping up there, both politically and militarily? Did you know? Did you have an opinion?
Well, early on, I was too naive to really fully understand what was going on. Again, it was portrayed as, we've got to stop communism somewhere, and this is where we're going to do it. And these are the bad guys, and we're the good guys, and it's all kind of black and white and simplistic. But I can remember at Stephen F. there were some groups there that were not in favor of it, and doing the folk songs and all that type of thing. And, but they were very small. But there were some dissenting opinions. It wasn't widely discussed in school.
Yeah. What did you think about those who were opposed to the war at this stage?
I didn't agree with them.
Mm-hmm.
I felt that it was time to do something, and that was the place to do it.
All right. Now, you said you went to Stephen F. for what, 2 years?
Yeah, it was in the second year when I had more interest in the military and about doing something, and I was looking at the Marine Corps PLC program, and I wanted to fly.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad had an airplane, was a pilot, and my uncle was a pilot, and all that, and I'd always wanted to fly. And the Marines had a program that I was looking at, and one day I happened to see a recruiter from the Army there with a table or whatnot and stuff, and that's when I found out about the warrant officer program for the Army. Didn't require a 4-year degree. And I was actually, at that point, I think I was more afraid that the Vietnam War was going to be over and I would miss it.
Really?
And so this, I saw it as an avenue to be able to fly and then be able to be involved before it was over with. So.
Interesting. So you decided to sign up right there, huh?
I did.
Yeah. Leave college and join the Army. That's quite a step.
Yeah, my dad, that phone call wasn't real good.
I was wondering about that, yeah. How did that go down?
He wasn't happy, and it was called everything from an idiot to a moron, but basically he said, you're crazy. First of all, you thought helicopters were horrendously dangerous and would fall out of the sky, and if they didn't fall out of the sky, then they'd get killed in Vietnam. So didn't pull any punches initially. Then he mellowed down. But,
what about your mother?
Yeah, she wasn't happy either, but she was less local.
Okay. Sounds like Dad had some very serious plans for you.
Yeah, he was an oil man.
Yeah.
A self-made oil man. So.
Yeah, sure. All right, well, you leave Stephen F. Austin after your second year. You've joined the Army. Pick up the story there. Where do you go to basic training?
Yeah, joined in May of 66 and processed in Houston and went to Fort Polk, Louisiana for basic.
So you go to Fort Polk. Well, at least you should be acclimated with the weather there, I would think, such as it was.
Yeah, and the mosquitoes.
And the mosquitoes, right. Well, tell me about your time at Fort Polk.
Well, I, it, it's one of these things I just wanted to get it over with. You had to do it because I had been accepted in the flight training program, but you had to go through that door to get there. And so I accepted it and went there, and because I had ROTC in high school, I knew how to march and left and right and so forth. They made me the platoon leader, and so we went, you know, the 8-week basic training the Army did at that point, and of course there were draftees as well as the volunteers. And the basic that I just wanted to get through it and get on with life and get to flight training.
Yeah. You obviously had a very clear set of goals that you're trying to accomplish here, but what about the others? What about the draftees that you mentioned? Was there a difference between those who enlisted and those who were drafted?
You know, I've heard, you know, a lot of talk about that, and I really didn't see a lot of differences. Everybody did what they were supposed to do, and I mean, you always had certain individuals that you'd have problems with, but the training was rigorous enough that you either did it or you were gone or in trouble. And so I never really discerned I'm a volunteer versus I'm a draftee, other than on your serial numbers. And you could tell who had been inducted and who was volunteered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, what was your routine like there in basic? Just give me the basic day. You know, a lot of people already understand what this would be, but you know, for someone who might not understand, or for future generations of the Kent family, what was it like for you in basic training?
Well, I can remember vividly arriving there, and we were bused from Houston. A group of us had been inducted into the station in Houston, and we got put on a bus and sent to Fort Polk and got there at night. And as soon as we got off the bus, the drill sergeants were lined up screaming at us, and their Smokey Bear hats and running around with their hair on fire. We started and lined us up to get our heads shaved, and I remember all that. And then we were we stayed at the Fort Polk. At that time was basically it was a World War II wooden building, just as they'd had in World War II. And we were assigned to barracks, as open bay barracks, as bunks, and so forth, and open bathrooms, and just, you know, basic living, and the old mess halls that they had in World War II, and company areas, and it was a self-contained little city in South Louisiana there, and we would start early in the morning and go all day until late at night, and then you were so tired, of course, you had no trouble sleeping, and it just had the whole routine that you had never had a minute to yourself, almost.
Mm-hmm.
So endured it, did what you're told to do, and tried to make it as easy as possible.
And for you, it sounds like, again, this was just another step toward your ultimate goal, which was to fly.
Right.
Would you characterize it as being any sort of cultural shock or anything, or you just understand that, hey, these are the steps we're making us go through, we just got to go through it, and we move on?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It was part of the deal, and just go with the flow and get through it.
After 8 weeks, you finish up. It sounds like you did reasonably well. You're a platoon leader with your ROTC experience before, obviously helped out.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the next step for you?
I went home and a short leave, bought my first car.
What'd you buy?
A new 1966 Mustang. Second year or so of the Mustang. And
wow.
So bought that for $2,100, and my dad had to co-sign it. And because of going to flight school, you got promoted to a warrant officer candidate, but pay-wise and rank-wise, you were an E5 sergeant. So could afford the car, and figured I better buy a car going to Vietnam. I don't know if they have a chance the second time here. So had the car, drove it to Fort Walters, and started flight school, but that was my first car.
So you go straight from basic training warrant officer, headed to Fort Walters for helicopter, the primary helicopter training program there at Weatherford.
Yep. Mineral Wells,
yes. Tell me about this. What was your first experience like with the whole helicopter world? Because there's going to be an awful lot of classroom involved here, in addition to the basic flying elements that you would be getting involved with. Take me through your time there at primary Fort Walters.
Well, before we got there at Fort Polk, that's one thing I admitted to you. Because we were going to flight school, they one particular day they took, they weren't that many, but the people who were going to flight school, they took us to the airfield there at Polk to give us a orientation ride. That was my first helicopter ride. It was in a H-19, which was an old reciprocating engine, Korean War era helicopter, on wheels. Loaded us in, and I always thought helicopters, I mean, watching TV, I grew up with Whirlybirds or whatever it was, the TV show, watching this, and the helicopters hovered when this thing, they started it, and it started shaking. I thought we were going to come apart on the ground. and then we had to, because the thing's so underpowered, and it's hot, and the thing couldn't hover. We had to roll down the runway to get the thing off the ground. God, what have I done here? This thing is a disaster. That was the first experience with helicopters. That wasn't too encouraging. So when I got to Walters, I was looking forward to it, but I was a little concerned too. But Walters, the first thing, the first 4 weeks, it was called pre-flight, and had nothing to do with helicopters. To weed out, you could withstand the discipline and the training and so forth, and if you could ultimately be some kind of an officer. So it was strictly military with attack officers screaming at you, it seemed like 24 hours a day, running all over the place and eating square meals and absolutely no time to yourself. They would purposely try to get rid of people, and they did.
And again, do you realize this is just one more step that you're going to have to go through?
Yeah, every all the way along the process, it was that goal of ultimately you wanted to be an aviator, and you knew you had to go through these doors to get there. You either put up with it and did your best, or you weren't going to be there. They had no qualms about busting people out. You were going to be a E-1 private with a rifle, and more likely in the swamp in Vietnam, and that's just the future. So
right.
There was that motivation to stay involved and succeed.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, after this initial phase, take me through the training you go through. Take me through the academic coursework first. What sort of things were you working on in the classroom?
Well, then we had an area at Walters that pre-flight was in the old World War II barracks. Then we moved, they called it up the hill at Walters, and they actually had concrete barracks with rooms, and the whole area was built specifically for the flight training program, and so they were modern by anything we'd seen before. The living conditions were better, and we had two to a room, and we had the military aspect, the whole thing had to be spit-shined, constant inspections. You had TAC officers again that followed you every step of the way, and they were constantly in your face and a lot of screaming and hollering still, but less as you started to evolve through the training process. And we would go to academics for half a day and flight for half a day, and start out with basic aerodynamics, the whole gamut of aeronautical courses, and the weather and navigation and all that type of thing, aerodynamics. And then we would start, and everybody, of course, was really looking to the flying aspect. And we finally evolved to that and got into a routine of academics and flying. It was very long days and very very long night.
What did they have you flying there?
Our class was split. They were, because they were ramping up the numbers that were training for Vietnam, they had to buy additional aircraft, and the original aircraft they used was the Hiller OH-23, and that's what I got. And the other half of the class was in the Hughes TH-55. And you didn't have a choice, they just assigned you. I flew the Hiller.
Tell me about your instruction there. What sort of guys were training you? Were these guys experienced Vietnam pilots? Who was training you there at Fort Walton?
Initially, pre-solo, it was a combination of, they were all civilians. There was a contractor there, Southern Airways, that had the contract for training and for the maintenance of the aircraft. So they were civilian pilots. A lot of them were ex-military, I would say most of them were.
Yeah.
And some of them were still like in the National Guard and so forth. And the instructors I had, I mean, you stayed with one instructor by and large, I did. And, you know, they were excellent. And I heard mixed stories. Some people had screamer type guys, and others were like mine, was much more approachable and really a good instructor. And so the quality of instruction I thought was excellent.
Tell me about the bird you're flying.
It was a reciprocating engine, it was theoretically a three-place helicopter. The Army had it for a number of years. Bubble helicopter, sort of small, and it was a good, for that particular thing, a good basic trainer. They actually used them on a limited basis, and when I first got there, it was a scout helicopter, which I wouldn't want to have been flying in combat, but it was, it had been around a long time before I got there, and they kept it fair number of years afterwards. And I actually flew them again in the National Guard when I got out of active duty.
What was your first experience like in one of these things?
Well, the first, they would start, the very instructor would fly and show you, this is a helicopter, and this is what we do, and you knew the controls from the ground school before you got in there. And they all sounded pretty straightforward until they actually gave them to you, and then all hell would break loose. It was a good thing is Texas is a big state, because when you learn how to hover, I was all over it. And of course it's in the summer, so it's hot, and then you're in this bubble helicopter with a greenhouse effect, and then you got the instructor sitting there looking at everything. Of course, you don't want to damage the aircraft or hurt yourself or him, so it was a bit of pressure. But they start you with one of the controls, and then they add another control, and then it just goes progressively from there, and you hopefully grasp it. And the goal was to be able to solo the aircraft in about 8 to 10 hours. And some people could do it. It was a lot of hand-eye coordination. It was not a control system on the Hiller itself. It was very sloppy. It wasn't very precise. So there was a lot of lag. You had to factor into the control movements, and that took time to figure it all out. And of course, you had to control the RPM. It didn't have a governor like a turbine engine, so that factored into it. So it was just a matter of hand-eye coordination and getting it. And like I say, some people could get it, but some didn't. And they would either recycle or they would bust them out.
Yeah.
And the ones that had more trouble than anybody were the older guys, because in the warrant officer program, they had older NCOs that could come in and sign up for it, and if they passed the initial test, they could do it. Well, they were pretty, these guys were, quote, old. They were maybe late 20s or early 30s.
That's ancient.
Yeah, but they were set in their ways. They'd been in the Army a while. They were, E5, E6s, and they hadn't been in learning in a subservient role like that, and some of them just couldn't hack it, and they wouldn't get out. Mm-hmm.
But is it something that you picked up on pretty quickly?
Yeah, I soloed in about 8 hours and 8 or 9 hours, and it wasn't easy, but yeah, it came to me, and the more you did it, the easier it got. And
sure.
Of course, they kept expanding what you were doing, and different maneuvers and that type of thing. So, after you got through that initial stage, there was more of a natural learning progression versus this huge pressure of can I do it or can't I do it? It was a building block type thing.
Yeah, and feeling more calm and more confident
yeah.
as your abilities got better too.
Yeah.
So you're flying these things. You're feeling pretty good about it. You're soloing. When did you graduate out of primary?
I started in June of 66, and finished in December.
Okay.
And we were at that time. From there, you would go to Fort Rucker in Alabama for advance, and they were having issues with availability of aircraft instructors and whatnot, so they asked for, only a few things I volunteered initially in the Army for was they asked for anybody who wanted to hold over, and because I was from Texas and it was coming up on Christmas, I thought that would be good, so I stayed an extra month there, and they called you a super senior. Help the TAC officer scream at people. And,
that must have been rewarding.
Yeah, it was a little payback, but it wasn't. You had a lot of free time, which was good, and then had the opportunity to spend Christmas at home. So.
Yeah. Well, that's outstanding. After Christmas of 66, you're going to go to advance there at Fort Rucker.
Right.
Tell me about Fort Rucker. Tell me about advanced flight.
I drove my car out to Fort Rucker, and it was, again, a lot of World War II era buildings at that time, but it was much more relaxed than Walters, and we were in a company, and we had TAC officers and so forth, and had to maintain military discipline and whatnot, but it was nothing like Fort Walters, and it was much more relaxed, and but it was again a routine of going to ground school and going to half a day and then flying half a day, and then we of course flew nights sometimes, but it was a lot less pressure in the sense that you'd been through the Walters experience, and it was you had time to do other things, and so it was more of a normal life. And we were, of course, flying the Hueys, which everybody wanted to do. And that was just, a lot more fun, a lot easier. And, so we progressed through that in different stages of the flight. Went from what they call the contact training, which is where you actually transition into the aircraft. You do the emergency procedures and all that type of thing. And then you'd go into tactics. The aircraft, and actually, as you use it in Vietnam, they would try to replicate what you would be doing in Vietnam as much as they could, and doing formation flying, combat assaults, and sling loads, and all that type of thing. Mm-hmm. So they tried to train, and all those instructors were all ex-Vietnam guys.
Okay.
And so they tried to make it as realistic as possible, which was hard to do, but that was the intent. And, went through that and finished that. We graduated and commissioned as a warrant officer.
Hmm. I wonder if you might expand a little bit more on some of the training here at Fort Rucker. For instance, the classroom training. You've already been through the basic, the basic things that you need to know about a helicopter and how it operates and flies. Hmm. And you're talking about the meteorology and things like that. How did the classroom training? Classroom experience differ from what you saw there in Mineral Wells?
Well, it was more specifically like Vietnam. Well, initially it was about the aircraft, learning the aircraft. The GUI is more complex than the turbine and the mechanics and whatnot about the aircraft. And then once you did that, it was into the use of the aircraft for combat insertions and resupplies. And formation flying was really big. And we did a section on flying gunships, learning what they did. And we actually went out and flew and shot the weapon systems. And then we'd do quite a bit of night training where you'd land and set up remote LZs throughout the area and do all the communications work using all the code books and that type of thing. And we did a survival school on the ground where you'd go and try to replicate, had a Vietnam village and try to replicate what it was like to E&E or escape and evade in the woods for several days and nights, eating what you could and so forth. But they tried to make it as realistic as possible as what you were going to see in Vietnam, but they couldn't. I mean, there were so many things they couldn't do because Vietnam itself is such a diverse country and as far as terrain and environment and conditions. So it was a general approach to what you're going to see in Vietnam.
Yeah. Well, now you get yourself to the Hueys here at this stage. Like you say, everybody wanted to fly the Huey. This must have seemed like a Cadillac to you guys, a great, big, heavy Cadillac after the Hiller. Tell me about your first experience with the Huey, flying this thing. What was it like? What were the controls like? What was the overall process like for you flying this big bird?
I thought it was so much easier because much more stable aircraft, and it had a turbine, and it had a governor on the engine, so you didn't have to maintain the RPM, which reduced a lot of the control inputs on the aircraft. You just applied power or reduced power, and it maintained everything. And so, overall, it was just a much simpler aircraft to fly. And it's like training for auto rotations, so the Hiller would come out of the sky like a rock. Flying characteristics in auto rotation weren't all that great, but the Huey. Very easy to auto-rotate the aircraft. And so, just on whole, it was just a much easier aircraft to fly, and much more comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody loved it.
Yeah. So you acclimate to the Huey pretty well, it sounds like.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that these guys, the trainers, most of them had been to Vietnam, mm-hmm. experienced pilots there. And you say they're trying to replicate the circumstances as well as they could. But what are they telling you about flying in Vietnam? I mean, it would seem very simplistic to say what kind of pointers are they offering you, but what kind of things are they telling you about what you're going to be doing, what you're going to be seeing, how you should approach these kinds of things?
Well, they had different instructors, so different ones had their own take on it, but there wasn't any, nobody got into any of the real negative aspects. They didn't really go into a lot of what they saw in combat. Because prior, up at that point in time, I mean, helicopters had been over there for a while, but they hadn't seen a lot of really heavy action. And, I mean, some had, but not generally speaking as the whole country involved. And so, you depending on who you were with, what instructor you were with, they would talk about, the living conditions and that they saw in their particular units and what the routine was and, what to expect and from a flying standpoint as far as, day to day. And they would, some of them flew gunships. Of course, they had a different perspective than the guys who flew the slicks. So it just varied. As far as the individual one.
Yeah. Now, of the two, which would you prefer, slicks or the gunships?
Well, when I was in training, I kind of liked the gunships, but it was had to do, and because we had very little exposure to it, really. They just like one day of actual flying the aircraft. And when I got to Vietnam, I figured that I wanted to fly those ships because I didn't like flying around, sitting there, and getting shot at, not being able to do anything about it. So
yeah, I think so. You mentioned the weapons training earlier.
Mm-hmm.
What sort of systems did they work with you on? What were you training on?
We fired, we had standard gunship, and which carried 14 rockets, and had the training aircraft had the M60 machine gun, the flex guns. We had four M60s and a flex pod on the side of the aircraft where you could, the co-pilot in the left seat could take a sight and rotate it, and the guns would turn and point, and you could shoot. And then we fired what they called it the Frog, which had the rocket pods on the side, and had 19 rocket pods on each side, and then they had a turret in the nose that fired a 40-millimeter grenade launcher. And then you could put a sight in the left seat again that you could turn and rotate, and the move in the turret in the front would rotate and fire that 40-millimeter grenade. So those were the two, as I remember, we actually fired in training.
How much time did you have working with these weapon systems?
Very limited. They didn't want you blowing up a lot of stuff.
Right.
We were on a range at Fort Rucker, and it was very, you can only do so much. So.
Yeah.
But they just wanted to expose you to it.
Right. Just in case you get over there, they have a need for a gunship pilot, you'd be at least familiar with it.
Yeah.
So it works. Okay. So your time there at Fort Rucker, another positive experience. You're feeling good about things?
Yeah. Rucker was, like I say, was much more enjoyable from just a personal standpoint as far as having some free time to do some things. And
what sort of things would you do?
Oh, you can play handball, tennis. Went to Pensacola a couple weekends. That was that some of the guys actually would have a house in Pensacola, because by and large he had the weekends free, which we didn't have at Walters. And, so he had time to do some things like that, see the local area, which is not too much to see in South Alabama. But we go to the club, and so it was a much more normal life.
So you finish up there, and obviously you know you're going to Vietnam. I mean, you're a helicopter pilot, you're a warrant officer. All this training is not being wasted on you,
yeah.
so you can fly around in the States or Germany or something. You know that you're going to Vietnam.
Yeah.
Are you still continuing to follow the war as closely as you can?
Yeah, it didn't dwell on it. We didn't have a TV in your room kind of thing, so you didn't get the nightly news unless you happened to be somewhere where there was something. Read the newspapers and the magazines when you had time, but you had such limited time for a lot of stuff like that, that I didn't follow it near as closely as I had prior to going in. But we definitely stayed, aware of what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
The military didn't really go into the politics, of course, or any of that type of thing.
But
there wasn't any discussions of the pros and cons. I mean, they gave you the history of what Vietnam was and why we're there.
Mm-hmm.
And but it was minimal.
Yeah. And the whole U.S. presence there still made sense to you at this point, didn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So you finish up at Fort Rucker. When would this have been? The spring of 67?
Yeah. I finished in June.
June of 67.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So is it this point where you get your orders for Vietnam?
Yeah, just prior to the graduation, everybody would get orders, and of course I got orders for Vietnam, and the majority of us did. Some were assigned to stateside units that were building up for Vietnam, and that type of thing, but the majority of us were going to Vietnam.
Yeah. Do you have any leave after you graduate?
Sorry?
Was there any leave? Do you have any time off after you graduate before you go to Vietnam?
Yeah, I had some time to come back to Houston,
mm-hmm.
and ready, everything ready. You had to, of course, prior to leaving, you had to sign all the papers and the insurance and that type of thing. And but had some time to go to Houston, got my car up in Jack's, and saw friends and that kind of thing, and was ready to go.
Yeah. Are you excited to go?
Yeah. I was eager.
What about your family?
By then, they had accepted it, and they drove out to Fort Rucker when I graduated for the graduation ceremony, and so they were much more accepting. And but you know, there was always that concern that something might happen, and never far removed. So.
Sure.
But it wasn't discussed either.
That you were, you know, somewhat eager to go, but do you have any trepidation? I mean, it's you're heading into a war zone in an animal that shouldn't be able to fly but does, with people shooting at you. Do you have any trepidation, any nervousness or worries about what you're getting yourself into?
No, I you know, again, it helps being young and and somewhat naive, but no, I, you know, I mean, part of this process is you're pumped up, the training is such that you think you know everything. You think you're the greatest aviator that ever lived, 210 hours. And, you know, they, I mean, that's part of the process, you know, the military was good at. And so, no, I realized something could happen. And we had people killed in training, and I saw people killed in training. And so, I mean, that brought it home that this is a dangerous business. But, no, I'm ready to go.
Just to go back just a little bit, you mentioned that you had seen some people killed in training.
Mm-hmm.
Can you describe those instances? What happened?
Well, the first one was at Fort Walters. They would launch, I think it was 400 or 500 helicopters a day from the various the main heliport at Walters and the two satellite ones. And so you had this tremendous number of helicopters going in the air every day and coming back. With very inexperienced people, these students, and some of the instructors and some solo. So by definition, you know, that was ripe for problems. And but then you have just the normal training accidents where people make mistakes and they get hurt. And so it was a fairly dangerous environment. But my first experience, etched in my mind, was we were recovering on the main heliport at Fort Walters, which was the biggest one. And they had these lanes that you would fly back, various colored lanes you would fly back that you would be assigned in a single file type formation coming in, or loose formation. And we had to stay certain altitudes over these lanes. And I was with my instructor, and the other aircraft were parallel to you coming in, and as long as everybody stays in place where they're supposed to be, everything's fine. But that particular day, one of the aircraft, we got the wrong place, and actually Hughes, T-55, had the rotor blades sheared off by the skids of a Hiller that they'd gotten tangled up in. And as we were going in, I'm barely keeping this helicopter right set up myself, and suddenly something went by the aircraft at my door in the corner of my eye, and it was a Hughes, the T-55, falling. Crashed and we landed, and it turned out it my instructor grabbed control and landed. And it turned out it was a guy in a couple rooms down from me.
Huh.
And I couldn't recognize him because he was totally smashed, but then I saw his name tag.
Wow.
And then I realized that this is, you know, this is serious. And then we had other accidents. But that brought it home. It was dangerous, but it was part of it too.
Yeah. Were there any other incidents like this?
There were other accidents, and yeah, personally, wasn't involved in any, fortunately. And, we had a fair number.
Yeah.
Not only any fatalities, but we had injuries.
Okay. Get you back to Houston. You're getting ready to leave. When do you leave for the West Coast?
In the early part of July, 67.
All right.
Went to from Hobby Airport to Oakland Army Depot there.
Okay. Describe for me the experience of traveling to Vietnam.
Well, I've got pictures of leaving home with my family all lined up, taking the departure picture, and I'm in my uniform, and I remember getting on the airplane with my wings on and all that, feeling pretty good, and went to San Francisco, and then went to the over to Oakland to the Army Depot to wait shipping, and just, in fact, I've got the letters I wrote my parents starting in Oakland, and so they, it actually helps my memory, because we just sat in a BOQ at Oakland for a few days waiting for assignments and aircraft going to Vietnam. But he didn't have anything to do.
Mm-hmm. Were you able to get out and see Oakland or San Francisco at all?
No, we were stuck on the base.
You were stuck there?
Yeah.
Okay. So after a few days of what must have seemed like, you know, just interminable boredom there, you're finally going to go. Take me on this flight to Vietnam.
Well, I was reading these letters the other day, and the typical Army, you get up at 3 in the morning for transit to anything, and we were bused from Oakland to Travis Air Force Base, out to the East Bay, and the airplane was broken. I remember sitting around forever, and so in this letter I described that, and then we're supposed to stop in Hawaii, remember, and Continental Airlines 707, full of 150 GIs or whatever it was, and off we go. And because of the delay, they went to, I think it was Wake Island, which was 9 hours or something. And because I write this letter about, I never had been on an airplane that long, and it wasn't very fun. And from there, I think we went to Manila, and finally to Saigon. And of course, get to Saigon, you're absolutely exhausted and so forth. And it was a long trip.
What was the atmosphere like among those who were on the airplane over?
Well, the airplane was mixed as far as enlisted and officers. They didn't segregate you. Everybody was intermingled, and of course, everybody was just real quiet. There was no real discussion about it. It was like, okay, we're here. Let's just wanted to get off this thing and get on with it. And it was a mixed bag of officers, enlisted, and varying ranks.
Yeah.
Different fields, the whole thing.
So you arrived there in early July, 1967. Come into Tonsonute.
Mm-hmm.
The doors open on the plane. Welcome to Vietnam. What takes place?
Well, probably what everybody in the world says is hot and humid.
Right.
Hits you like a wet blanket. And that was it. And so, and the smell. The smell. I've got a lot of pictures and whatnot, but you can't can the smell for Vietnam. So that was our awakening.
So once you're off the plane, where do you go?
They put us on buses, and the thing that I remembered was Army buses, and they had wire on the windows. They wouldn't throw hand grenades through the windows. And I can just remember driving through the streets and looking out through the wire and thinking, okay, this, we're sitting ducks here if anybody wanted to do anything. And stuck in the traffic and so forth, going to the replacement depot. And again, everybody was so tired, you're just, and it's like a zombie. So, looking at what Vietnam was like with all the traffic and the rickshaws and all the horse carts and whatever, the buffalo carts, and it was culturally, it was a real awakening for somebody who's never been out of the country other than Mexico.
I bet it was.
Yeah.
So where do you go? Where do you stay while you're waiting orders?
went to the replacement depot in northeast Saigon at Long Bend.
Mm-hmm. I guess what the 90th, I guess.
Yeah, the 90th replacement center.
Yeah.
And went there and very basic quarters and so forth, and just the normal drill of paperwork and sit around and wait. And we had no idea where we were. We had, I think they'd given us a, because the orders had actually changed several times as to where you were going, but you really didn't know, because once you got there, they would need to change, and they would assign you wherever they needed you. So we just waited for the orders to go someplace, and finally they came through.
And your orders were to where, what unit?
To the, it was the 13th Combat Aviation Battalion down in the Delta, the 4 Corps. Flew down on a caribou and their duffel bags and whatnot, and arrived at the battalion and sat around there for, I think, a day or so, and so we got the assignment for the company. Because the battalion had 4 companies throughout the Delta. And so they didn't ask you where you wanted to go.
You were just going.
You were going.
Did you know anything about the Delta region?
Well, again, in flight school, they've given you the broad overview of Vietnam. This is with the map, and this is that and the other, and this is the culture, and the pictures of it. But it was, I had really no idea. No, I mean, I knew it was flat, and I knew they grew a lot of rice, and that was about it.
Mm-hmm. All right, so welcome to the Delta. What unit or what company do you?
I get assigned to the 121st Assault Helicopter Company in Soc Trang. They were the Soc Trang Tigers. I think you've talked with them.
Yes, I attended their reunion a few years ago.
Yeah, they were in Lubbock, I know.
Yeah.
And I missed that one. But it was one of the first units to go to Vietnam. They'd originally gone to the 93rd Transportation Company and been assigned to Dong Tam, mm-hmm. or to... up north, and the irony of it is that the Army was up there, and the Marines were down at Soc Trang, aviation helicopters, and the military finally figured out, wait a minute, we've got the Army where the Marines are, and the Marines are where the Army is, we need to do something, so they assigned a guy to Bert Leach, who first to go to Soc Trang and accept the airfield from the Marine Corps. He was an Army captain and went to Soc Trang and signed the papers to accept the airfield. The Marines had their Marine Corps emblem on the water tower there, and Bert became the airfield commander, and suddenly the Marine guy was the colonel. And Bert's first order was to have him paint the Marine Corps emblem out on the water tower. The Marines weren't too happy about that. They were supposed to leave the next day to go to north, and they made their displeasure really known to Bert. But he was probably at that reunion. He's still going. Really a good guy.
It's pretty funny. All right, now you're with the 121st. You're down in Soc Trang.
Yeah, by the time I got there, they'd become the 121st Assault Helicopter Company. So they were one of the original aviation companies in Vietnam. They arrived in country in 62. I think they were in Soc Trang by 63. They became the Soc Trang Tigers, and they were at an air. Soc Trang was an old airfield that had been built by the Japanese in World War II. And the Japanese had actually stayed down there when they sank the British ships off of Singapore down in that area. The Repulse, I think it was. They'd actually, some of the aircraft had flown out of Soc Trang. So the unit itself, for most units, it was actually considered a premier unit because it had been there quite a while. They had a lot of experience. They were actually, when I got there were guys on their second tour. And so it was a somewhat of a prestige unit, which I didn't know at the time. And conditions we had, the airfield itself was much nicer than a lot of places in Vietnam. And so it really, from that standpoint, it was a very lucky assignment. It was a great unit.
Describe the base there at Sauk Trang. Give me some details. What did this place look like?
It was south of the town of Sauk Trang, which was a little village, and like everything in the Delta, everything revolves around rivers. So that was their main way of getting around. And there's one road at that time, Highway 1, that ran from the Delta, south of the Delta, all the way up north, and north of the Vietnamese border, but went to Saigon from where we were, and it ran right by the base. So the base had a runway. You could land C-130s there. And then the buildings themselves, a lot of them had been built by the Japanese, the hangars and then quarters. And then the Army and the French had been there too. So the Japanese, French, and then the Americans, the Marines, and then the Army. So they had been through quite a few iterations of people there, and in fact, we had mama signs that did the laundry and shined your boots and so forth, and cleaned the place and so forth. And the mama sign we had, she had been through all of them. She spoke Japanese, she spoke French, and she spoke English. It's a little bit of both, or some of all. But her whole thing was, she didn't care who came in as long as they paid her.
Right.
So she had seen them all. But we had an officer's club, the Tiger's Den, they called it, and it had air conditioning, which was unheard of almost.
I bet it was, yeah.
And the rooms, that we had little rooms that were were bamboo, basically, walls, and big bamboo beams in the ceiling where they hung up, and they were hot. But the whole goal in life, once you got there, was to get a fan. Hard to come by with, I did. But by Vietnam standards, when we had latrines, we had showers, had a bed, and so by Vietnam standards, it was pretty good.
Yeah.
And, we actually had a swimming pool, had a little library, and chapels, PX. So I saw a lot worse, I'll put it that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it sounds like a pretty good assignment for you. Overall, not just the physical layout of the place, but the kind of history that the unit has, the success and experience that they have. Can you tell me about the people? Tell me about the command structure. Tell me about the people who were there with you when you come in.
Yeah, we had two companies assigned to Sauk Trang, the 121st and the 336, which were all part of the 13th Battalion, so we shared the field. And so some of the people that were there were traveled with me and gone all the way through flight school. There weren't that many, 4 or 5. And then there were, like I said, experience varied from people that were on their second tour. And they were kind of revered because they were like the resident experts.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had the guys like me and enlisted guys and whatnot that were brand new. So it varied. It was like a little city. We had all kinds of different people. We had air traffic control. We had the medics. And we had a dust off unit there too. We had a bird dog unit. And then the various supporting units, maintenance units, and that type of thing, communications units. And all, there were probably somewhere around 400 people there. It was like I said, a self-contained little city. Because we had to be, because we were at the end of the food chain as far as supplies went, because we're a southernmost unit in Vietnam, aviation. And most everything came in by air because they couldn't transport it over land because they'd get ambushed. And that type of thing. So the majority of it came in by air. And there wasn't a lot to be bought in the surrounding area.
Tell me about the people. What's the command structure when you get there? Who's in charge?
When I first got there, was a guy named John Kenny, he's a career major, in charge of charge of our unit, and a really good guy, and wasn't there for all that long after I got there. They would cycle the people through, particularly the senior officers. They would usually come in and get their ticket punched for their career to be a commander. And the 121st was a premier unit to be a commander because it was, like I said, it did name recognition. And then they would move them to battalion headquarters and that type of thing. But we, overall, the majority of the people we had were all dedicated. They were, you know, career army and good people. There were always occasional ones that you had problems with, but that wasn't the majority at all.
Yeah. How were you welcomed into the unit?
Well, initially you come in and we would fly the transport aircraft, the Slicks, and that was your first assignment. And so you'd get checked out, you get a unit checkout, just like you'd take a check ride at Fort Rucker. And again, you were pumped up, and of course you thought you knew it all. You'd be assigned as a co-pilot, and first assignments would be, we call them ash and trash, where you would go out to just pick up people or pick up supplies and make it into an outpost or a village, or you were just an aerial taxi, basically, flying with an experienced pilot. And by experience, I mean, he'd been there maybe 2 or 3 months. And you would fly, we'd fly at least 100 hours a month, sometimes 150, and it just varied. And then after a few weeks, you'd start to fly combat assault, where you'd fly in the formations. And combat assault, of course, were where the rubber meets the road, because you're flying in these formations of usually two sticks of five aircraft, 10 aircraft, and then you go and pick up the troops, and you keep formation into the LZ with the troops. And sometimes they were under fire, sometimes they weren't, and you'd insert the troops and then try to get out of there as fast as possible, and then you'd have to come back in and resupply them if they were still in the operation, and then eventually extract them. And so the combat assault was the most demanding aspect of the whole thing. That was where the steepest learning curve was for me.
I wonder if you might take me through this in a little more detail, Mr. Kent. You know, from, say, your first combat assault, if you can remember it, or just one in general, how does the planning take place? When does it take place? What are you going to be focused on doing? Take me through, in as much detail as you can, a combat assault from your perspective.
Well, they would, usually the night before, they would give you the assignment, who you're going to be flying with in operations. We have a base operation, we have operations officers, or officer and staff, and then they would get their assignments from battalion, and we would be supporting in the Delta, which was one of the negative things, is we would be supporting primarily South Vietnamese Marvin troops, and which I didn't know going in, and but it became apparent very quickly that, you know, they weren't the most aggressive ones compared to the Americans, and they had American advisors with them, and that type of thing, but the brunt of the people we would transport would be armed. And so we'd get the assignments, we'd get the aircraft, and they would have somebody from operations come in and wake you up. It was always early morning, usually dark, and get our gear together and have breakfast. Go to the aircraft, and usually we would form up on the airfield in formation. You'd have a lead, and you'd have a trail aircraft, and the lead, everybody would fly off of him. You'd maintain a 45-degree angle off the aircraft with stepped up one rotor distance away, and try to keep as tight as possible without running into somebody. And then we'd fly to a staging area where the troops would be in various places around the Delta, depending on because we worked everywhere from basically Saigon south to Timor, Vietnam, to the Cambodian border, to the South China Sea. And so we'd go to the staging base where the troops would be, and then meet with the ground commanders there and the advisors, American advisors, and find out exactly more details. And then the gunships would go out and pick the LZ, actual LZ, based on the coordinates and whatnot that they'd been given. And they would select the LZ, mark it with smoke, and the transports would come in from reporting points, various reporting points, and there'd be a command and control aircraft above everything with a ground commander in it, and they would be communicating with the ground troops and as well as the aviation people. And they would call for the insertions. The gunships would prep the LZ, and usually on the actual assault end of the LZ, they would be on either side of the flicks going in. The flicks each had M60 machine guns on either side, and they could, depending on the situation, they could tell them to be firing, two gunners in the back to be firing on the tree lines or whatever going in, and then the gunships would parallel that and fire. Troops, you'd come in, and some places you could land, some places you couldn't, some places the problem we'd have quite often was the aircraft were very, very heavy, and it was hot, and you're landing in rice paddies and mud and water flying around, and if you're getting shot at, that compounds the issue, and you're trying to maintain position of the aircraft you're flying off the whole time. That's what you're looking at. You're not looking around at the LZ. And so the performance of the aircraft, some places you just you run out of power, and you just have real problems with that. So that was always the concern. So those were the things you learned, and a lot of that was technique and the flying, and that's what you evolved is over the course of this thing. And then the troops would jump, they would usually start jumping out before you were on the ground, and so they wanted to get out of there. They were out, we were gone. Depending on how many loads you were bringing in, you would continue that process until they were all in, and then you would support them with supplies and whatnot. But it was some days you'd fly it all day long, and into the night. Other days it was quick. It just depended. But the combat assaults, you were the when you knew you were going to do those, everybody, you know, the interest level got a little more.
Yeah, I'm sure. And like you said, this could go on potentially, you know, all day.
You never knew. No.
Yeah, yeah. Depending on the size of the operation, how many trips back you have to go and pick up more soldiers, or what it's going to be, and ammunition, and what they're engaged in.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's an awful lot of balls up in the air, I guess, as we look at that. Now, do you remember your first combat assault?
Not really.
Yeah.
I can remember one of the first ones, recovering back to one of the stage fields with the extraction and flying in a tight formation coming in.
Take me through this one. Take me through the whole thing.
Well, we would at the end of the whatever the operation was, we would go in, land, and hopefully, and quite often the extractions were under fire because of these. The bad guys knew where these guys were. And the South Vietnamese were very predictable. I mean, they just did the same thing all the time. And the VC would figure all that out, of course. And so they would wait for these extractions, and they would be there. So they could be under heavy fire. And so we'd go in, get the troops on. They would be covered in mud and stink. Someone would be wounded, and then we'd pull them out, and we'd go back. And I remember coming into one of the first flight times I was actually flying the aircraft, and coming in, trying to maintain formation, but I was way too fast. And when everybody flared to start landing, I was way too fast. I almost ran into the aircraft in front of me. I had to fly. Had to fly basically almost through the formation because I couldn't stop.
Wow.
And scared the hell out of me.
I bet you did.
The aircraft commander wasn't real happy. And and then he grabbed the controls. But that was a when I remember I realized I didn't know everything.
Sometimes that's a very good realization.
Well, yeah, if you survive them, you're learning steps, and
you
go on and you don't do it again.
You mentioned, you used the word flair. For someone who's not familiar with this term, can you explain what that means? It's obviously very, very important for a helicopter.
Yeah, well, it's like an airplane, too. When you come in to land, you're at a certain speed, and then as you go to actually land, you're coming in on the approach, and when you actually go to land, either as a hover or on the ground, in the case of a helicopter or an airplane, when you land on the ground, you pull back on the control. So that slows the airspeed, and in a helicopter, you transition from the flight mode to the hover mode. Well, it takes more power to hover than it does to fly, because of the airflow through the rotor system. So you're coming in, particularly with heavy aircraft, you have to plan to just go straight to the ground because you can't hover. So as you're coming down, you're pulling back in the stick, and the nose is coming up. Dissipating airspeed, and then if you're going to hover, or if you're going to go to the ground, you've got to start coming with power because you're transitioning from a flight mode to a hover or landing mode. And so the flare is basically you pull the nose up and the tail down, and then level it and approach the land. You just don't want to be too steep. And then what happens sometimes is guys would hit the tail and knock the tail rotor off, and that wasn't good.
Well, I'm glad you're able to explain that. So on this, you come in a little hot, as you say, and the aircraft commander took control over it.
Mm-hmm.
What happens at this point? Does he chew you out or anything, or just let you know that he's displeased, or what goes on?
He didn't chew me out, but I remember just feeling like, well, plus you got the crew in the back, so they know what's happening. And you feel like a heel, and you think, well, you could have killed me. Everybody here and other people did it, plowed in through the formation. So, no, it was very humbling. And I felt horrible. And you just didn't want it to happen again.
All right. What do you do when you're done with one of these? You've been out flying. Say this is an extended day that you had today. You brought a lot of troops in. You've been resupplying. An extraction's taking place. What happens when you're done?
Well, it was a routine, and again, in these letters, I talk about this because the normal thing would be you're tired, and depending on when you got back, we had, like I said, we had an officer's club with an air conditioner and cold beer, and we'd go to the Oak Club to the Tiger's Den, and typical military buddy'd sit around and eat, or we'd have dinner and eat, and then go to the bar and talk, and the whole war story things would get bigger, depending on who they were. And we did have a room that had a projector in it, and we'd get movies very infrequently. I think we watched Bonnie and Clyde like 30 days in a row. Some of the guys would go to the movie, some would just go back and go to sleep, read. But there wasn't a whole lot to do in this little field. It was, you're around your friends, you're around your people all the time. But again, it's a lot better than a grunt having to live out in the jungles and sleep in a water-filled hole and that type of thing.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So,
you mentioned getting dinner. What sort of food were they serving there to help you today?
The food wasn't so great. We had Vietnamese cooks. We had a lot of Vietnamese that worked on the base. Waitresses, we had Vietnamese waitresses, but the food was, a lot of it was freeze-dried, that type of thing. It was very powdered eggs, powdered milk, powdered this and powdered that. Occasionally we'd get access to some decent food, some steaks or some fresh food from usually the Air Force, scrounge it with the Air Force. They always live well, but by and large, it's pretty mundane and boring food. But I was, for a while, the pay officer, and so I'd have to go to Saigon to get the pay, and it was all in cash. And military certificates would be used for cash. But we could go to Tonsonut, and we had a liaison NCO there for the battalion. He had all the contacts, and we'd tell him what we wanted and what we needed to trade. We'd take old weapons we'd gotten from the ground troops and stuff, and VC stuff, and flags. We had some guys make VC flags that we would throw in the mud and shoot with bullets and tell them it was captured at some battle, and take that Tonsonut and sell that stuff, and we could buy decent food. And so there's a lot of Air Force weenies around today, I'm sure, that have these flags on their walls telling how they captured these things. We'd actually had Mamasan make them. You had to do what you had to do, and we had some very resourceful people.
Yeah, a case of steaks is a case of steaks.
That's it.
So you have these facilities here. You mentioned, you know, the library, the chapel, you know, the officers' club and things.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously sleep is going to be a very important thing for you, I would think. In addition, you know, just blowing off steam, decompressing after a tough day, and those kinds of things. What other sort of things do you do? Are you listening to music? What kind of music are you listening to? Writing letters? I know that you mentioned that on a couple of occasions. That seems like it was pretty important for you as well. What sort of things do you do in your off time?
Well, the biggest thing to do over there when you first got there was, like I said, we had the luxury of having a quote room, and you try to get the room fixed up as best you could. We had a bunk and the little cabinets and stuff, and so you try to get that fixed up. Some guys had all kinds of elaborate stuff in the rooms that you got shipped from home or bought somewhere, and so the first goal was to get a fan, which you get the fan, and then if you get survived and help you sleep. And then next thing was to get a stereo system, because it was cheap. And everybody wanted a stereo system, so that was kind of a rite of passage. And so you get order that when you could afford it through the PX. And you get the reel-to-reel tapes and speakers and the whole thing, and amplifiers. And some guys would set it up in the rooms, and I never did. But I kept it in my room. But then I realized we would get mortared and rocketed and stuff, and when these things would hit, they'd wipe out the room. So I put all my stereo gear in under sandbags, and they were still in the boxes. And not thinking that it hit, the mortar round would turn you into hamburger meat, but I'd have my stereo gear and still be there to go home. I'm not sure the rationale behind all that, but guys would read a lot. We wouldn't wear civilian clothes when we were off duty, and I didn't have any when I went over, and had my folks ship them home and ship them over there. We'd get stuff shipped from home, food, canned food, and whatnot occasionally. The airfield itself would get people coming through. We rarely had entertainment. Prior to me being assigned there, there was a gal, Martha Ray, and she was a TV performer and whatnot at that time.
The troops loved Martha Ray.
Yeah, and before I was there, she apparently liked to go to Suk Trang a lot and hang out. There was a flight surgeon there. Lived in Pueblo, Colorado. They had a big battle one night, and she was due to perform that night. Well, they had this battle, and a bunch of people were injured and wounded and whatnot. Well, they just had a small little dispensary at Suk Trang, and this one flight surgeon and some medics, and very limited facilities and people. And anyway, he was overwhelmed, and Martha Ray walked in and said, "Oh, do you need some help? Do you know anything about medicine?" She said, "Yeah, nurse." Well, she wasn't a nurse, but she'd been around medicine apparently in some state. And she rolled up her sleeves, and they were doing amputations and everything else, and she was helping. And he's written a couple books, actually, about this whole experience in Vietnam, which is really interesting. And really a nice guy.
Yeah.
So we would occasionally get some performers through. They're usually Filipinos or something like that, but that was rare.
Bob Hoakley when he was first with him.
We did all every diversions of all kinds of pets for people. GIs are great for finding those, and we had all kinds of pets, much to the chagrin of the COs usually.
What kind of pets did you acquire?
Before I got there, the unit was called the Sock Train Tigers. The reason being is they had a tiger. They got it as a little tiger, and there's pictures. I've got pictures of it. And the little tiger grew into be a big tiger, but this tiger had roamed with the base, and they call him Tuffy. So the unit became the Sock Train Tigers. But they'd have people fly in from someplace and come around the corner, and here'd be the tiger walking around. So at some point, the CEO said, "We got to get rid of it. It's too big." And they actually got to somehow figure out how to get the thing to the zoo in Toledo, Ohio, where he resided for the rest of his life, making more puppies.
And, well, be darned.
Yeah. But it was the Sock, that's how the Sock Train Tigers came out. And the patch we have has a tiger on it and all that. But we had, I had a little otter. Dogs. We had a dog, four, and we had a monkey. That we had one CEO. He's a great guy, but he came in. He was a West Pointer, very smart guy. He had a PhD, but he spent all his career basically in the Pentagon, thinking about war and talking about war, but not doing war. Just to be a promoter, he had to participate. So they assigned him to 121st, because it was the prestige unit. And he came in, and traditionally when somebody would come into the unit in the officer's club, we would welcome them by, we had this fan we modified, and we'd take the banana trees, and stick the banana tree in the fan, and the guy would come in and hose them down, and well, this guy came in, he looked like George Patton, starch fatigue, and pearl hand pistols, and stick shiny boots. And he went from looking like that to looking like the green weenie, and real quick, in his first time around the Tigers, and he got really mad. And by then, I was in the gun battalion, and we were the rebels, and we were the ones doing it. He wanted an inspection the next morning for us, and of course, we didn't even understand the attention at this point, and came in, and we were all lined up, and at the end, we had the monkey in the cage, and we had a little flight suit for him, with his wing and his name on. And he bent down to look at the monkey, and the XO behind him, and the officer up there, and one of the monkeys reached down, took a handful of crap, and threw it in the
cage. Oh, no.
And all of them spin around, fall down over each other, and we get these orders, and all the monkeys will be off Sock Train on the airfield by 1800, and that kind of thing. And we just, at that point, hid the monkeys, didn't let them see us. But, typical GI, there was always something that wasn't supposed to be there.
Right. What about music? What sort of music takes you back to Vietnam, as it were? What sort of things were you listening to?
All the standard stuff at the time, in the O Club tradition was the song "I Want to Go Home." They would always play that at night. It was all the popular music of the time, you know, all the folk songs and that type of thing.
Mm-hmm. Beatles, Stones, Motown, those kinds of things.
Yeah.
All right, cool. Now, you also mentioned that a lot of guys like to read. What sort of things were you all reading?
The library had very limited stuff. I subscribed to the Houston Chronicle, and I had that. The mail was sporadic, depending on what was going on. And we were kind of at the bottom of the food chain, so it'd take a while. I think I subscribed to Time or Newsweek or one of those, or Life magazine. You get books sent from home.
What about the morale of this unit? It seems like it would be pretty strong, I would guess. Did you find that to be the case?
Yeah, the morale was overall good. We didn't see the drugs or any of that kind of stuff. I never saw any of it. Of course, it was aviation. Doing that kind of stuff and flying,
yeah,
working on the aircraft. And then, but yeah, I would say overall the morale was good. I mean, it was it's kind of a two-section thing because I was there pre-test, and then of course we went through a test, and then post-test, different atmosphere. The biggest negative of the whole thing were the Arvins, according to the Arvins, and the more you were there, the more you came to the realization that it's a joke at times because they just didn't have the will to fight. So here you were out risking your life for these people who didn't want to fight, not like we're sitting in Iraq right now. And that was demoralizing. You wanted you knew what you could do and what could be done, and your hands strong for these people who wouldn't fight. That was the most demoralizing. And it wore on it, particularly after that. But there was nothing you could do about it.
I wonder if you might go into this a little bit more. I know that you mentioned this on the questionnaire that you filled out about the overall kind of negative opinion that you had of the South Vietnamese units in terms of willingness to fight and things like that. Do you have any examples of this? Where do you think this came from? What do you give me your thoughts on this?
Well, what really brought it home to me one time was the Vietnamese had helicopters. But they operated the old Sikorsky H-34s, which was a reciprocating engine helicopter. The U.S. Marines operated those up north at Da Nang. But the South Vietnamese had them where we were, and so we would work with them. And they were, they just were not aggressive, and they wouldn't expose themselves. And we would get really fun. In fact, I blew one up when they didn't have gunships, so by then I was flying the gunships, and we were supporting them. Fraction. And one evening late, and it's getting dark, and they come in with 10 aircraft, and they take off with 9. There's one still in the LZ running, and they don't speak English anymore, and they're gone. And someone's got a machine gun, and I've got the radios, it's got all the equipment on it. And the VC are coming out of the tree lines, and you can see them. And so I just came in and blew this thing up, because the wife was had been shooting at us with that stuff. And the only reason they had left it is they'd taken a couple rounds, and one of the guys got wounded, and they just left the aircraft. But that was the mentality. But anyway, I was talking to one of the South Vietnamese pilots one time, and he asked me, he said, "How long are you going to be here?" And I told him, and he said, "Well, you know how long I'm going to be here." And he said, "I'm not going home. This is home." He said, I got a family. I have no end to this. I might be doing this the rest of my life, but nothing changes. It put a different perspective on it. I had an end date, and even in a family. There was that element of it, but their ground leaders were really not good. And, there were certain units that were special ops, rangers, and like that, but their basic ones were just poor. They had no leadership.
You mentioned the letters home on a couple of occasions so far. What sort of things would you put in these letters home? What sort of things would you get back? It seems like this is pretty important.
Yeah, well, the letters I have are the ones I sent home. My mother saved them, and I only got them a few years ago. But they're just detail from Oakland. They on there talking about that and through coming home, and I was shot. Talked about all that, and not any detail, but when it was being backed up to Japan, and talking about that, and it gave me insight in a lot of things I'd totally forgotten about day-to-day stuff. A lot of the letters I'm complaining about pay, because the pay was always screwed up, and I was having to get checked in kind of home, and they were going to, it was messed up, and I'm whining in these letters like a little two-year-old. And I find it, of course, it's hilarious to read, I talk about, life and stuff, trying, but I never really told them a lot of the stuff, or most of the stuff. It was definitely glossed over. But there were some insights, and some of it I did at the end there was expressing frustration and the desire to go home.
Ken, I think we've probably got to a good point to stop for today. This is Kelly Krager continuing an oral history interview with Mr. Barton Kent. Today is 11 June 2015. I am in Lubbock, Texas, on the campus of Texas Tech University, and Mr. Kent is joining me by telephone again from his home in Bainbridge Island, Washington. Okay, Mr. Kent, before I turn the recorder on, you were talking about these letters home again. Can you expand on those a little bit? Just, you know, what was the content, maybe the purpose of the things that you're writing to your parents? How does it feel to look back on these things and reread them after all these years?
Well, yeah, I have the letters that I wrote home to my parents, the ones I have, and my mother obviously had saved these, but they're still in the original envelopes with the return addresses of where I was and the stamps and so forth. But then knowing or the postage marks and whatnot, so that they have the dates when they were sent and so forth. But it details basically the time from Fort Walters, when I arrived at Fort Walters for training, up to going to Oakland Army Depot for transition to Vietnam, and then the trip over, and then the time in Vietnam and coming back. And it early on, I was very impressionable, and seeing the Vietnam up close and personal for the first time was obviously an eye-awakening. And I briefly kind of talk about that with in the letters. But the early letters are such that it portray the place as being pretty nice as far as our conditions and living conditions and the base and the unit and so forth and so on. But as it goes through the year, things become a little less favorable. I don't get into a lot of discussion about the actual conflict or what we were doing. It's just very limited, but more about things we were doing as just day-to-day life. Basically, the common theme was I was bored. And there's a routine that you get into, and there's only so much you can do in an Army airfield and surrounded by the enemy, which we were. And so it was very limited as far as and it wore on you, it's obviously in collecting these letters, because there was just so much you could do. And I actually look forward to the flying, because it would get you out of there and give you something to do to pass the time. But then as things went on and you got closer to going home, like it was reflected in the letters that I was definitely looking forward to going home, and actually was counting the days. And I mentioned those in the letters. So it's interesting to go back and read them after all these years and provide an insight as to how things were day to day.
Yeah, I would think so, and I would assume also kind of put you in touch with, you know, your own thoughts and feelings. Though it's been, you know, almost 50 years now, I guess, it would still, I would think, spark a lot of these memories that probably don't seem that long ago once you start to think about them.
Exactly, yeah, pretty much.
That's really interesting. Now, we left off last time. Again, you're kind of discussing what life was like there at Sauk Trang, there on the airfield, and, you know, kind of the day-to-day things that you were doing, both in terms of, you know, getting ready for action. You talked about going out on a number of missions. Are there any other things that come to your mind about this early part of your tour that you want to discuss, any of the personalities or events or missions or anything that comes up?
Well, what came to realization as I got into this, or the flying, was that, in fact, in one of the letters I talked about, explained normal type of flight, we would fly from this village to that town to this and that, go to Saigon, come back here, just hauling things and people around, including, I mentioned at one time, hauling the wife of a Vietnamese general to Saigon to go get her hair done, sitting at a Tonsonette waiting for this woman and her girlfriend to come back for the beauty parlor, and I thought that was ironic, because that's not what it signed up to do.
That is pretty bizarre. How did that come about?
It was just typical. You just get assignments as the flights, you had no idea what you were going to do until you were given those assignments, and that particular day came up, take General so-and-so's wife and her friends to the Tanzanut and wait there, and she was going to get her hair done and do some shopping. And she did. That's when it started coming, you know, a little bit of the, this is not what I spent a year plus training and hoping to do, is the whole women around getting their hair done. I was looking forward to the combat aspect of it. That surely wasn't it. But it was part of it. And then as things evolved in the combat side, we became disillusioned because of the, again, supporting the Arvins and their lack of aggression and doing the same thing over and over. And we would insert them in the morning. They wouldn't spend the night. We'd pull them out in the afternoon, and they'd come out after pillaging the local villages with their chickens and ducks and things, and it was their lack of incentive that was demoralizing to us.
Yeah, that is really interesting. So typically it would be a morning insertion and an afternoon extraction.
With them, yes.
Yeah.
The times we had exceptions were when you worked with their more elite units, the ranger units, and their special forces people, and they were good, but they were limited. Even their basic line units all had American advisors, and of course we'd work with them, and they were our liaison. And the advisors would be very, very frustrated, just trying to get motivation. But it just continued to become aware of, here we are out here risking our lives, and for what? Because it wasn't near as aggressive as we expected.
Yeah. Well, again, that's really interesting. If you were on, say, a typical mission of bringing the Arvin soldiers in, you know, how would that mission take place? Obviously, you're going to be briefed probably the night before what's going on, where you're going, coordinates, formation, who all's going, that sort of thing. But that morning, when do you get up? What is your routine, and how does this mission work? Take me through the process.
Well, we'd get up early, 4:35 in the morning type thing, usually, and be awakened by runner from operations, and then we'd get our stuff together and have breakfast, and go pre-flight the aircraft, and we'd have certain times when we'd crank the aircraft, and everybody would line up at our base at Sauk Trang and in formation, and then we'd take off and fly to, usually, most of the time, we'd fly to some other site in the Delta, and from Saigon south in the Four Corps area down to go pick up the troops. And hopefully they would be there on time and whatnot. And we'd liaison again with the American advisors and get the coordinates and the location of the LZs. And then we'd load the troops, and we would usually carry six of them, sometimes eight, because they were smaller than Americans. We could put more in, lighter weight. And they would usually sit three in the door on each side of the troop ship. And then we'd have a crew chief and gunner in the back, of course. And then if we were carrying more, they'd be in the middle. And then if they weren't strapped in or whatnot, they'd just sit in the door. And we'd take off in the formation and go into the LZ. And they would get out as soon as possible, and we'd get out of the LZ. And then they would do their thing during the day, and the gunships would support that during the day. And then usually in the afternoons, we'd come back in and extract them. And I mean, there were exceptions where they'd get into contact and get tied up and whatnot, but that's not what usually their intent was. It was to get home at night.
Yeah. Take me through landing troops in a hot LZ. What would take place there?
Well, the whole intent was is a quick pilot, you were just maintaining your flying formation, and ideally you were in a two Visa 5. You wanted 10 aircraft going in the LZs because you wanted to be able to place an adequate number of troops on the ground that if they got into contact before you could get additional people in, they could defend themselves long enough. So ideally, you go in with the 10 aircraft. And again, we'd go in with the VF5 if possible, but a lot of the LZs weren't big enough, so you would modify the formation into a trail or a staggered trail or whatever it took to get in the LZ. And you try to maintain the formation as tight as possible and close as possible. And it, you just focus flying off the aircraft you were flying off of. And of course, there was a lead ship, and he had the map, and he had the coordinates, and the challenge of landing the aircraft as optimally in the LZ as you could, where the other aircraft behind them could get in.
Mm-hmm.
And so, we were going in, and it all depended on the conditions, but the Slicks had two M60 machine guns on the side, and if we were receiving fire, weren't friendlies on the ground, that type of thing, that would allow the gunners in the back to fire, just hopefully suppress the fire, but realistically they probably made more noise than hurt anything. And you just get on the ground or get as close to the ground as soon as possible and get out. And very limited radio calls, just try to keep it brief. Trail ship would call the flights down, and then the trail ship would call the flights ready, and everybody would go. And again, if things happened, if somebody got shot up, they couldn't get out, and so forth, everything would change, of course, and you'd adapt to whatever the situation was to get your people out, or whatever it took.
Yeah.
So, there was a routine, but then it was the exceptions to the routine that always get exciting.
Yeah, I think so. That's the way life goes, isn't it?
Yeah.
if you continue to support these guys on the ground, you got to go back and get ammunition or food or water. Where would you do that? Would you be going back to Sauk Trang, or would you be going to different bases?
No, we'd go to the satellite bases around the Delta that we were usually where we'd picked up the troops. They'd have supplies there and ammo and fuel and food. Water and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And then if they were wounded, they would we'd try to send in the dust off aircraft, medevac aircraft. But depending on the situation, at times the Slicks, we would haul the wounded out, depending on the conditions. And that wasn't ideal, but again, you just did what you had to do.
Right.
And then, I mean, there were times when we just haul bodies out. Did get in contact with the only way to get them out was just load them up and fly them out.
Yeah. What kind of impact does something like this have on you as a young man? Flying in combat, hauling out wounded, hauling out KIAs. Do you have time to think about this while it's going on or afterward? What kind of effect does this have on a young man's body and mind?
Well, while you're doing it, you don't have time to think. Responding to the training and doing what you're supposed to do, and you're looking out for each other. But you know, it's again, when you're down, you have time to think, and yeah, you see that stuff, and it's not something that you forget, and you process it, and just think, okay, it's going to be somebody else. It was a lot harder, frankly, when it was somebody you knew, of course. And the Vietnamese, you kind of distance yourself in a way. But we knew some of those. We'd get to know some of those. Not necessarily the ground troops, but the aviation people. And they became friends. So that impacted you a great deal more than just the... Because the other stuff you tend to distance and just was impersonal. But I mean, when you would haul the bodies, it was some of them. You know,
smells were just overwhelming. And we had learned that you carry Vicks with you, put Vicks up your nose. That's the only way you contend with it, because they're right there in the aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
So you did stuff like that that weren't normal. I mean, part of normal life. But you did it, and it became normal.
Well, are there any particular missions that kind of stand out here in your early part of your tour?
Well, the first one we got hit by ground fire. I remember that one vividly because I didn't know what it was.
Tell me about that. Take me through this episode.
I was a co-pilot still, and we were up on the Seven Mountains area, which is in the northwest corner of the Delta, right on the Cambodian border. Seven mountains. The delta is, of course, flat, but the mountains are right, they're fairly tall, and they're up, they protrude, so they're distinctive. And they were the kind of the base for the U.S. Special Forces operations, which we really liked working with. The Special Forces Green Berets, they were phenomenal. And so we were up there resupplying them and moving them around. Going into a little outpost, in one of the Special Forces outposts, and suddenly I was flying, and I felt the aircraft shake, and I heard the noise, and I assumed we were taking fire, but I didn't realize we'd been hit, we landed, and it wasn't even any lights or warning horns or anything like that, but it was it hit the couple rounds in the belly of the aircraft right behind the pilot seat, but it didn't do any real damage.
What were you hit by?
Small arms.
Mm-hmm.
We had taken some rounds in the rotor blades. That was the first time. And after that, you never forget what it sounds like when a bullet, when you're taking fire. So.
Mm-hmm. Again, is this an episode where you see this, you recognize what it is finally, or is there a fear factor taking place here, or not until the mission's over?
No, there was no fear, and frankly, even afterwards, that's just, you expected stuff like that,
mm-hmm.
In the slicks, we didn't go looking for trouble, we were trying to avoid trouble.
Sure.
And so, it wasn't a daily thing where we took fire, but it was just part of the game. Deal with it.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were shot down on more than one occasion, isn't that correct?
Well, we were hit, and we went down. We didn't fall out of the sky or
okay.
Anything like that. But we took rounds and knocked out systems where we had to go down. And they were controlled the landing, but we were down. We were in enemy territory.
Hmm. And when did these occur?
That was in the gunships.
Okay, so this is a little later on then?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, let me ask you about that. When did you transition to gunships?
Well, that came fairly, realization fairly soon that I wasn't really enjoying it. I mean, the flying the transports was, as we discussed, it was stuff I really hadn't, I got signed up for.
Mm-hmm.
And again, we were, did get shot at, you couldn't do anything about it but sit there. And so the gunships were, they were out looking for trouble to go out and suppress, the enemy and do things. And I decided I'd rather be doing that than just taking women to get their hair done and the other stuff.
Right.
And so to get in the guns in the unit. Gun platoon, and it was called the Vikings, which
right.
Was part of the 121st. And it was one of the original gun platoons ever, gun units in Vietnam. And when they first went over there, they were experimenting with how to do these things and whatnot. And it was it had a reputation, and so you had to, it was a bit of a fraternity thing. You had to be in volunteer and be invited and go through some stuff like that. And be accepted by the unit. So I started that, and there was a fellow there named Jerry Daly who had was back on his second tour, and he was an older guy. He'd been in the Pennsylvania Guard prior to that, in his 30s, so he was really old. But he had flown guns all during his first tour, and was a real pioneer in the use of gunships. But he was a warrant officer, and he had a captain that was as good as a platoon leader, but Jerry Daly ran the unit. He was kind of, we call him the gun god, and he had to go through Jerry to get the gun, so he was very intimidated. He had to fly with him and whatnot. And Jerry, I think Jerry Daly had flown in April of 67 before I got there. I got there in July. He had Easter Sunday battalion in a major exercise, and several aircraft shot down, and commander, the full colonel had gone in to try to get the people out, and he was killed. Jack Dempsey, who they named Dempsey Heliport after Walters. And Jerry Daly and Larry McDonald, another one of the experienced gun guys, had gone into the LZ with a ship we called Viking Surprise, which had a smoke generator and whatnot on it, and screened the LZ. Allow the dust off and the others to come in and get these people out, and the dead and the wounded. And so they made multiple passes to screen the LZ and the downed aircraft from where the enemy was located along tree lines. And it took 113 hits, Huey, which is a lot in any aircraft, but 113 hits and flew the aircraft back. Of course, they jumped the aircraft when they got back. But they put Daly in from Medal of Honor, and got the DSC and so forth and so on. But he was a great guy. And so anyway, to get into the Vikings, you had to go through Jerry.
Yeah, so it was pretty intimidating, like you say.
Yeah. So I got accepted and started with the Vikings. And,
now, when did you start this?
In October.
October, okay.
And so as part of the, once you got accepted, then you went out and did a couple training flights. At it, because you'd start in the left seat as a co-pilot gunner, and the gunner would fire the flux kit, the machine guns, the sight, and you'd go out to the area and fire those and get the hang of that again, and then start your first mission. Well, my first mission, I got shot, so I had a kind of a short career there for a while.
Well, tell me about this. How did this all take place?
We were north. Tuck Trang, it was up near Tan An area, which is south of Saigon, closer to Saigon than Tuck Trang. And we were supposed to support resupply of an outpost, and we did. In the morning, there were the Chinook, and we escorted the Chinooks in, and nothing happened, and they resupplied this outpost. And remember, we went back and landed and refueled and whatnot, and had lunch with the Chinook crew, and back out, and normal routine was we'd go out and we'd recon the area that they were going to land in, and stay high, and we'd go down low and recon the area, and assuming it was okay, we'd go out and escort the aircraft in, which we were reconning the area, and we had just started that, and we took fire, and we took, I think it was 13 rounds, but it hit on the left side of the aircraft, so which is where I was, and gunner in the left side. He hit him in the chest. And of course, he had a chest pressure turn. And the only thing I can remember is getting hit. And I said I was hit, and I knew what that was. And then it felt like somebody hit you with a baseball bat. And then I looked up, and the sight for the flux guns was hanging there. So my vast experience in a gunship, I grabbed that thing and started shooting, because I knew we were trying to disengage. You always broke away from the fire. And by then, the pilot was firing rockets just to make noise as we broke, and then our wing ship was covering us as we broke. And we cleared the area, and then the gunner, the seat pilot, told the crew chief that got knocked out of the aircraft in a monkey strap harness. But he was kind of hanging out of the gun mouth inside the aircraft, and he had pulled him in. Well, he'd been hit in the chest protector, which is the Kevlar, and had all gone up in his face. It shatters like glass, and all went up his neck and his face. Of course, head wounds bleed prolifically. And I looked down at him. I saw this big hole in his chest and saw blood everywhere. I just thought he was dead. And the gunner pulled me on top of him and was trying to get my boot off and whatnot. And all of a sudden, the crew chief started moving under me. And I looked down and I said, well, I thought you were dead. And he was screaming to get off him. But, it turned out he just had a very sore chest, but wasn't seriously hurt.
Wow.
So, he was lucky.
Yeah. And what was the extent of your injury?
Well, I was hitting the, just above the ankle, broke the fibula, and so the intercom was shot out and whatnot. It was hard to communicate, but we went direct, straight back to Sauk Trang, the nearest medical facility. We had a small dispensary there, and went back there and went into the dispensary, and the flight surgeon was there with medics. The pulmonary stop bleeding and so forth, and debrided the wound, I remember that. And then they put me on a dust-off aircraft and backed up to the U.S. 9th Division, which was at Dongtan, north of Sauk Trang, the Mekong River. They had it was a complete division base, big, and they had an evacuation hospital, which was like a MASH hospital. Air blew the thing up like a tent, and it was a complete hospital though. But I was there. I got more doctors, but I remember being there and the IVs and plenty of medicine, drugs and stuff. And then they got mortared at night, and the thing started deflating. And by then I'm on these drugs, so I'm not really caring about too much. But I can remember thinking how funny this was. This thing deflating because the nurses were running around squealing. Really, anything I could do, I was just lying. But anyway, then the next day I got evac'd up to the Third Field Hospital in Saigon, and there was operated on. And in both those places, one of the negative things was they were seriously injured people in there, losing legs and whatnot, dying.
Yeah.
And they just were so crowded. Wall-to-wall patients and that bad, and because there's nothing I could do except sit there and lie there, and just felt so sorry for these people. And the doctors and the nurses and the medics were all just overwhelmed. And so it was, the conditions there were, in Vietnam, the medical conditions were kind of primitive from that standpoint, just because they had. So, after one or two surgeries there, they evacuated me to Japan because they were overloaded there.
And where did you go in Japan?
Flew in a litter in a 141 up to Tachikawa Air Force Base, and we were transferred over to Camp Zama, and they had buses and litter capability and medical buses, and we were back over to Camp Zama, which is an army field. It was the old West Point for Japan prior to and during World War II. But it was an American army base, still is, and they had a hospital there. It was an old Japanese hospital. But the conditions there were much better. They had separate officers' wards, and it wasn't crowded, and the facilities were everything.
How long were you there?
Well, I had another operation, and then I was in a cast, and got discharged from the actual ward in quarters, and we got into a walking cast. And I had met there was a fellow in Ward Whitney, who was a civilian, he was from Hawaii, and he was a teacher there at American, on the base, and he was Japanese American, and he had appendicitis or something. But anyway, he got out, and then he and his wife, they lived there, and they lived on the economy, and they invited me to their house and went to dinner, and they were really kind. They took me around Japan, showed me the place, and it was just a really great experience. They were just very, very nice people. I had two children. And so they took me and the infantry guy, the infantry officer, who was the same boat I was in, basically the outpatient at that point. So they took he and I all around that area and showed us Japan. It was really a lot of fun. So I was enjoying that. And then I had the funny part was, then I had my uncle, the naval officer, the 06, who was on the staff of an admiral, a three-star admiral, in Hawaii. And they were in that area. They had been to Korea, and then they had came to Japan on a quote inspection trip. It was just prior to Christmas. And I think they really on a shopping trip, but anyway, my uncle knew I was in the hospital, so he got a hold of me and said, well, you should come down to Tokyo and have dinner with us. I don't know if they'll let me out of here. I'm like a little army guy and whatnot. And so, you know, we'll take care of that and we'll let me get the pass. And so I got directions written out in Japanese and how to get to Tokyo from Zama. It's about 40 miles, I think. And so this infantry guy, I invited him to go with me. And I'm on crutches, and he's all bandaged up, and he didn't look too good. But we went to the train, got on the train, and away we go. We went to the American officer's village in Tokyo, and I met my uncle. And that night we had dinner with his admiral, of course, here I am. I had no clothes, I had nothing. Other than what I had in my back, being a back, we didn't get anything. And so the guy, the admiral, asked me if I wanted to go to Hawaii with him. I said, no, I can't do that. I'm in the army here. They want to get out of here. I'm supposed to go back to Vietnam and treatment, and all this. And he said, well, I outranked the army general. I said, you just get your stuff ready, and we'll go tomorrow.
Huh. What was this admiral's name, by the way?
I can't remember.
Huh.
But he was a real funny guy. And so I went back to Zama and not thinking anything would happen. Well, I got this call, and the army colonel saying, be ready at whatever time it was that afternoon. You're going to go to Atsugi, which was the Navy base where the admiral's airplane was. And you're going to Hawaii. I get an army staff car, pick me up, took me to there, and here I am hobbling around on the ramp, and there's the admiral, and he's all happy, and going in his airplane, big four-engine airplane, with a recip, but it was like a C-54 or a DC-7 type airplane. Or something. Went inside, and there's this thing, looked like a corporate jet is. Tables and doilies and Filipino stewards. He had a bedroom in the back, and off we went. We landed in Midway, and they treated me like a king, and then we landed in Hawaii. My uncle lived there and had a house. Stayed with him. His admiral invited me to their Christmas party. He had a big house out at Pearl Harbor. He showed me the bullet holes from World War II where he'd been attacked and all this. Anything I wanted. Basically, the guy just they opened it. The Navy treated me a lot better than the Army ever did.
This story is just incredible.
It was.
Mr.
And,
Kent.
And my uncle, he got a Navy S-2, which is a twin-engine anti-submarine warfare aircraft. He got the airplane, and he and I just spent one day flying around to all the islands and looking there, landing and having, walking. Of course, I'd never been to Hawaii. So I had my uncle, my personal pilot, and personal airplane, and that was great. So anyway, it was a super deal, and I'd go out to Tripler, and therapy. And they couldn't understand what I was doing for either. That was another issue, trying to explain to Jeremy what I was doing there and what the heck was going on. So anyway, then the thing, I had orders to go back, so I went back to Japan. And of course, by the time I hit Japan, it was the army was ready to get rid of me and send me back to Vietnam.
Right.
I'm on the way back to Vietnam real quick. But it was quite an experience. And
that's quite a Christmas.
It was, and my family came out from Houston. And,
oh, really?
Something never would have anticipated.
Yeah, that's really a bizarre set of circumstances there.
Yeah.
But obviously, you know, incredibly fortunate.
Yeah. From that standpoint, it's fantastic. And, but my uncle, he's still alive.
Yeah, that's really cool. When you get back to Japan, you say that they're basically ready to get rid of you, ready to send you back to Vietnam, and this would have been January of 68, correct?
Early January, yeah.
All right, now, things are going to go south in late January of 68,
yep.
Pretty quick, quite a departure from your Christmas in Hawaii. But take me back to early January of 68 when you get back to your unit. You know, you've been gone for a while now. What have they been doing? What's your reception when you get back? You know, what is your routine when you get there? Are you ready to hit the ground running, so to speak? What goes on when you get back to your unit?
Yeah, well, that was, I got back, I think it was around the first week of January, and because while I had been gone, there was an underlying sense that, you know, I felt guilty that here I am, not there with the guys. And,
mm-hmm.
There was a bit of that, and in some aspect, I wanted to get back and get on with it. And so, got back, and everybody, they've been at the unit. They've been told that I was going home. I wasn't going to come back. So they packed everything up, but fortunately, hadn't shipped it home yet. So I had to redo all that. But got back, and then the normal thing. Took a few days to get going again, and my records were all screwed up, and trying to get all that straightened out. And had to get in, you know, another check ride to get back up to flight status. And did that. And then by then, I mean, things had already been ramping up as far as activity level, and they were, of course, telling me about all that. And the base was getting mortared more and packed. Activity level has been increasing, but nobody had talked about some kind of major conflict. And so anyway, I just basically just got back up to speed flying when the tip thing hit, and then from that point forward.
Okay, now that we've got to this part in the timeline here, I'd like for you to take me through the Tet Offensive. When it starts, what happens immediately. Take me through the progress and the process of what you're going through and the unit is going through while this is taking place there in early 68.
Well, as soon as I got back on flight status and started flying, and we were on missions almost every day. I have all my flight records still from so they detail the hours you flew each day and give you a little bit of a summary of where you went. But I can see, looking back, just the number of hours we were. The gunships, a lot of times we would not fly the total amount, the total hours that, say, the slicks would, because they would do, you know, things during the day, whereas gunships, the only time we flew is when there was a problem, we were looking for a problem. And, but just looking at the flight records, we were flying a lot every day. And then the actual Tet Offensive, I'd flown all that day on an operation. Flight time, which is a lot of flight time when you're going, and, you know, the average length of time you flew a gunship was about an hour and 15 minutes. So that's a lot of flight. And when you're going back and refueling and rearming and whatnot. And so by then we were keeping a gunship over the airfield at night, all night, because of all the mortar attacks and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
dark, and it would get dark, you know, we'd send a gunship up. So we'd have one gunship go up for an hour, and the other one would go up for an hour, and we'd come back. And everybody, the biggest challenge was to stay awake, because you're so tired. And we'd take the, we'd have two pilots, of course, and two gunner and crew chief in the back, and the gunner and crew chief would be asleep as soon as they got in. And one of the pilots would fly for 30 minutes, and the other one would fly for 30 minutes, and stick your head out the window to try to get air and whatnot. And we had an ADF radio, which was an automatic direction finder, but it also could receive commercial broadcast stations. So we'd tune in the radio, so I'd go out and crank it up. And try to stay awake most of the time. And anyway, we were up that night, and they told us that it was Tet, a celebration, traditional celebration for the Vietnamese, and up in the air, celebrating, and so forth. And so that would be downtown in the village, and we were south of there, and in fact, the airfield is south, and we shouldn't have a problem. So we started seeing gunfire, and it could have been fireworks too, but it was all going up, and then we went from going up in the air to suddenly getting sucked right into the airfield. And the mortar rounds started coming from every which direction, and all hell broke loose, basically. And it, we flew all that night, because our only defense, our defense we had down there, were supposed to be the Arvids, and we had bunkers around the perimeter of the field, and that type of thing. Well, they left. They had left before the attack. They knew something was coming, and they left. So our defense, I mean, we had people on the ground at the field, that, you know, the 300 or 400 people that were there, and they were, you know, so you had mechanics, you had cooks and clerks and that type of thing manning the bunkers. And then the gunships, and so there were the two gun platoons on the unit, the Vikings and the Thunderbirds, with, you know, the other the guns for the other company. So we had eight aircraft, 10 aircraft optimum that were available. Come in and we'd fire and come in and land and under fire and refuel and rearm, never shut down, and go back out. As soon as you cleared the field, you could start shooting because they were all around us. And that went on, and it seemed like it went on forever. And we were taking jets and losing people, and the aircraft were getting shot up, and mechanical problems. Days progressed, and even during the day we would take fire and stuff, and we were sleeping in the ditches, and we had our personal weapons all lined up and whatnot. So the main thing, you just were getting more and more tired. You just never could sleep, and the aircraft were just taking a horrible beating, and we were getting short of people because of people getting hit. So it was getting pretty bad, and running low on ammunition, running low on fuel and food and everything else. And they'd gotten on the south end of the field, and some of them were in the wires, and we would stop them on the perimeter. And so you got down to the point where you're so tired, you realized you were in a bad situation here. And we were at the end of the food chain in Vietnam, again, the southernmost unit. Of course, all of Vietnam was under attack, and we just, it was very difficult getting kind of support, because everybody was in pretty bad shape. So we were, kind of had an Alamo mentality at the end. It was like, okay, you're gonna be here, and what are we going to do, and this is going to be the every man for himself kind of thing. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, it was really desperate. It was in the afternoon, and all of a sudden, nowhere, two F-4s came roaring down the runway, firing at these people who were on the south end of the field. And it was like the movies. I mean, everybody was up, jumping up in their weapons, cheering and whatnot, and they were dropping bombs right there. And that stopped them. And so that was the turning point, and then they were able to get a C-130 came in. It was kind of a and it was unbelievable because he was taking fire all the way in, taking fire, never shut down, just dumping stuff out the rear end the whole time, fuel and ammo. And so that we, at that point, from that, that we started getting supplies, and we were able to turn the tide. But we killed a lot of them. They came out of the holes, and we could see them, and we really did a lot of damage. So it changed from that point forward. It was a different complexion. I mean, just before, you had to get permission to fire and all this stuff, and by the time you did, they were gone. They tried to take us on. Militarily, we beat them. Politically, of course, it was something else. But it was, from that standpoint, it was a different conflict from going forward.
How long did this heavy contact last?
Most of February was just intense. And not saying the threat of being overrun, but they were all over the place. We actually found their command and control headquarters, which was turned out it was south of Bok Trang, and it was on a river like everything there. And it was a Buddhist pagoda, and we would fly around it, and we'd see all the sampan and stuff, and we kept thinking that there was something going on there. We couldn't get permission to fire, and the South Vietnamese, the command and control aircraft, wouldn't let us. And finally, as things evolved and became any worse, we asked for permission to fire. We call it recon, by the way. We take the door guns and just spray ammunition, just spray fire around the area to see if we could get somebody to return fire. And they did, and all hell broke loose. They opened up, and all these Buddhist monks were at AK-47s over their robes and that type of thing. And so we opened up on it, and the thing went off like a blowing candle because it was their supplies, their ammunition dumps and whatnot. And we leveled it, basically.
Wow.
And that kind of turned the tide as far as the heavy pressure. From that point forward, I mean, there was a lot of activity there. The rules of engagement changed too, because we didn't request permission to fire and whatnot. We just took them on. It was much more aggressive.
Yeah. Now, what is your obviously the defense of Sok Trang is the key here. When you're under attack, like you're with rockets and mortars and VC sappers and all this stuff going on here, how far away from Sok Trang would you get to go out to search for these guys?
Well, during the actual conflict, as soon as you took off, we were under fire.
Yeah.
They were all over the place. They had actually, the funny part was, they had a first sergeant there that had been there for years, before I ever got there. And he was a living legend kind of thing. And this guy, he must have had pictures of Westmoreland and everybody, because anything he wanted, he got. And he had his own quarters. I mean, this thing was like it was an unbelievable way this guy lived. And so he was a wheeler dealer, and during the midst of this thing, it was funny because we're taking fire from a building right downtown with 50 caliber fire, which we couldn't contend with. And we didn't have, we were firing 7.62 stuff. But they're right downtown on the roof of this building firing right down the runway at us. And so we start shooting at it the best we could, and coming at it from different angles and putting rockets in it and stuff. And we're in refueling and rearming in the revetment in the middle of the night, and the aircraft running, and this guy, the first sergeant guy, comes running up, and he starts screaming above the engines and everything that we're blowing up his building. And he said, "Honey, we're blowing up your building. You got a 50 caliber on your building shooting at us." And he had a restaurant or something down there. But we blew that thing up.
Wow.
But it was ironic that here you have a guy like that in the midst of all this, worried about his business getting blown up. But Vietnam, it was a chance to do.
Wow. and this goes on for most of February, as you said, when you're not flying, what are you doing? I mean, you've got to eat, you've got to rest, you've got to do the daily things, but you're constantly under fire here at SOC Train. What is that like? What does the routine become during this month?
It's just, you're so tired that any time you weren't in the cockpit, you were just sleeping or trying to. And like I said, we were in a ditch that paralleled the abutments and the runway. And we'd sleep in there and as best you could. And I remember getting so tired and so exhausted, and I finally said, I'm going to take a shower. And so I went in and took a shower, and the water still was. And I remember coming out and walking back to my ditch, and here this bullet hit right, I felt it actually right in front of my nose, and it hit the sandbag right next to me. I still have it. And it was, but I didn't care. I was just like, okay. I just picked the bullet out of the sandbag. Still, like I said, still have it.
Wow.
You just accept, you were just so tired that you got to the point you just didn't care. And of course, that wore on you in flying, because the flying thing it was wearing. But the main thing I remember is just the exhaustion and how tired you were.
Yeah.
And of course, we lost people, and that was very, very hard.
How many people do you think you lost, just roughly?
No, but between the two units, we had a lot wounded, and I don't have any idea how many, because we were trying to evacuate them because we didn't care for them. In our gun platoon, we had, four or five that were killed. And, but then, I don't know, to be honest, how many of the whole base. We took a number of casualties. The unit on the south end of the field took more than we did because they were on the south end of the field. We had them on the perimeter of ours, but they got tied up in the concertina wire. One of them was a barber. We had a little barber shop. It was an officer's barber shop, a little tiny Quonset hut. And this guy had been there for years before I got there again, a Vietnamese guy. And he would give you a haircut and use straight razors to cut your hair. Of course, we all had flat tops and stuff. So enough skin you. And it turned out we found him dead on the concertina wire.
Hmm.
He was a D.C. colonel. And he had maps on him and bunks where everybody was located and whatnot. So they knew, I mean, with all of them working on the base, I mean, they knew who was where and what was where. They targeted certain areas.
You mentioned the barber. What does this mean to you? This guy had been there for a long time, and apparently you obviously thought he was a pretty innocuous character.
Mm-hmm.
And then to see that, what does that mean to you?
Well, it was, the workers on the field, you kept your distance. There was never a friendship with any of them. I mean, they would come do their thing, and they would leave. I mean, there were the women and the mamasans and stuff. But we suspected them, some of them, not necessarily individuals, but just overall, we just felt that, things would happen that somebody got to know something.
Yeah, sense of unease, I guess.
Yeah, there was a sense of distrust, and we didn't, like where the gunships were on our ramp, we wouldn't let them anymore near them. And, so there was that element prior to that, but then after that, it was, we really were suspicious.
Yeah.
But what some of them had worked there for years.
What about eating? Is it just sea rats, or,
yeah,
or how are you feeding yourselves?
Well, during that thing, it was just sea rats, yeah.
Yeah. It must have gotten old.
They get old on a good day.
I would imagine.
Day after day, they really get old.
Yeah. And you guys are obviously, like you said, you're kind of at the end of the food chain, as you say, down there so far south, and the entire country is under attack for the most part. Are you guys screaming for supplies? Are you screaming for support? What's going on here at the upper levels?
Yeah, there was all that going on. But again, our battalion headquarters had been almost overrun over in Kento. And then our sister companies up at Bin Long, that field was partially overrun. In fact, we actually got sent up there to help them because they were really in bad shape. And so, I mean, and of course, Saigon was under attack because they got on the embassy and so forth. We didn't know all this. We just knew it was a broad-based attack. But we were careless about that. We were more concerned about our own area.
Of course, yeah.
But the intelligence, it would come in. I mean, we'd hear this outpost had been overrun, that place, and this and that and the other. And it was nobody anticipated that. Nobody thought they had that capability. So it was really surprising.
What is it like? I mean, you mentioned how exhausted you were in the flying. But, you know, there's also the aspects of, you know, maintaining the aircraft and getting them up and flying and making sure that you've got the rounds loaded up, that you've got the rockets, that you've got the ammunition that you need, you get the fuel that you need, all this taking place under fire. What is that environment like?
Well, it was, you adapt and you do the best you can given the situation, and mechanics and crew chiefs and whatnot, they did a phenomenal job trying to keep these things going. Because not only had the aircraft that you'd have to keep going, but you had the weapon systems, because if you didn't have the weapon systems, the aircraft wasn't any good.
Right.
So they did a phenomenal job of patching stuff up, and when the aircraft would get shot up to the point where they could fly, they'd cannibalize them and do whatever they had to do to keep them going. A lot of times they were under fire out in the runway.
Yeah.
Working on this thing, and they did a phenomenal job.
That's just incredible.
Yeah.
And who is it? It's still the ground crews, I guess, that are providing the protection.
Yeah, they were still out there in the perimeters and the bunkers, and they were on the line the whole time.
Yeah. I would guess that when you're not flying, you're sleeping or eating or preparing to fly, and as soon as you're ready to go, you're back up in the air again.
That's it. Yeah.
Yeah. There would have been no point in having you out there with an M16 on the perimeter, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I remember one time I went into the officer's club. There was nobody in it, and just trying to find some food. And there was a guy sitting in the bar, and there was nothing in the bar. But he was supposed to have left that day to go home for his zeros.
Mm-hmm.
And he had had a pretty rough tour anyway, but near this thing had happened, and he was stuck there. And he said, I remember saying that, he couldn't believe it, but he was going to have to go out on the line and help out. So he did.
Yeah, that's pretty rough.
Bad timing.
Yeah, timing's everything, I guess, isn't it?
Yeah.
So what kind of toll does this take on the aircraft under there? How many of them came out still operational?
It kept getting, obviously, less. I mean, at the very end, we had like four aircraft still going.
Wow.
Because the others, we were cannibalizing. The other unit on the field, the Thunderbirds, they lost more than they actually had. I know they had one that was shot out of the air. It burned, crashed and burned right off the runway. And they were down to just one or two.
And you mentioned that toward the end of the month, you see these F-4s kind of deliver you guys to some degree from all of this mess. And then you had the transports coming in. How close were you to running out of ammunition?
Very close. We were rationing it as much as we could and looking around everywhere we could for additional supplies. But we're also really low on fuel. When either one of those had run out, we'd have been in real trouble.
Yeah. And all the mortars, all the rockets, the shelling, the POL and the ammunition weren't hit?
some of the ammunition was, yeah, and not a lot. I mean, not the big where the big supply was, but I mean, we'd have like rockets out on the flight line and these little mini bunkers, and but the rockets were somewhat exposed. And I can remember sleeping right by one where a mortar round hit, and luckily the rockets didn't go off, but it ruined them all. And there was some fuel, I think a fuel truck or something hit in there, but fire. But a lot of the buildings were hit.
Yeah. Yeah, it must have just been a month of chaos. That would have been incredibly exhausting. I obviously couldn't imagine that.
Yeah, it was.
Okay, well, tell me about this. Once you guys start to get resupplied, and you've kept their heads down, you've obviously taken your own toll on the VC who were around there. Tell me about the immediate aftermath of this. What are you guys doing? You mentioned that it was kind of a different type of war, in that you were no longer waiting to be fired upon, that you're going out being more aggressive. The rules of engagement had opened up in your favor, I guess, quite a bit more. Tell me about the, you know, ending this phase of the war for you there at Stock Train.
Well, I mean, everybody took the VC and us. The activity level diminished for a while because everybody was expended. So we had to kind of regroup, and they did too, I'm sure. And but once we got through that wall, then we it picked up, and we would. I mean, the rules of engagement were such that if we saw certain activity in certain areas, we'd take it under fire. Whereas before, like I said, we had to get permission. We didn't pull any punches, and so we were very aggressive in that aspect. And the tone of everything had a more aggressive feel to it. And the conflict itself, we wouldn't see them in the mass numbers or anything like that, like we did during the Tet offensive, but we did definitely have a fair amount of contact with them. And I mean, one time we found several companies of them lined up in an area that we actually thought was friendly troops, and they were, it was kind of a ditch that they were in, and we realized they weren't friendly, and we took them under fire, and it was a class, I mean, it was one of these things that actually textbook example of the way a tactic should work, and we took them under fire with the gunships, and then they started basically not running, but they were migrating out of this area, trying to get away, and they went to an area that was a beach, part of the South China Sea, and they pop out on the beach while the Navy was sitting there with patrol boats, and we decimated them, and it was one of these things that everything went the way it's supposed to work, which often wasn't the case. We actually, they found, during that case, they found one or two Chinese, they assumed they were Chinese advisors, because they were much, we noticed they were much, the bodies were much taller than they seemed bigger, and they put the papers and whatnot, and they were Chinese, which we'd never seen before, particularly down there.
Yeah. Yes, but it's pretty far south.
Yeah. So we did, I mean, we operated a lot up on the Cambodian border where their supply routes were, trying to interdict them. And quite often that was, we actually went into Cambodia several times when that was an era when we didn't go into Cambodia.
Right.
Politically, we weren't acknowledging we were there. They gave us these blood chips that we went down, and we told that our families would be told we were killed in Vietnam, not in Cambodia. And there was nobody coming to get you right now. And we were working with special forces. And,
tell me about that. Give me some details on that. This sounds really interesting.
Well, it was up in the Seven Mountains area with the special forces guys, and they would get inserted into Cambodia, and I mean, that's where their supplies were. And they would go in and capture, kill, they would have intelligence of where some of their leaders were and stuff, and go in and get them and do other things. And I really don't, they never really told us a whole lot, but we would support them. And it was limited. We didn't do this a lot because it was not a good thing if you got caught up there. And but we would go in, and that's the first time I ever saw a tank was up there, the North Vietnamese tank. And of course, we couldn't take on a tank and anything to counter that. And so we saw much bigger weapons up there. They had a lot of their equivalent 50 caliber weapons, and they had the 37 millimeter, which fortunately we didn't see but once or twice.
Yeah.
But it was not stuff that we really could handle, and that's where their supplies were. I mean, there were trucks and all kinds of equipment. But we'd work with Special Forces guys and then get them out of there when they finished what they were doing, get them back.
So you're kind of bringing them in, inserting them, and pulling them out afterward?
A lot of night stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And they actually, one of the funnier things was they actually, Special Forces would tell us about hearing helicopters come over there or around their locations at night, flying from the north to the south, and they weren't Americans. And, we went up there and spent several nights camped out up there with them, waiting for these helicopters to come by. And what we were going to do, I really don't know, but we were going to our radar control. Looking for them, but they were going to pick them up on the radar and then vector us into them and we were shoot them down. I don't know how we're going to do that in the middle of the night, but that was we got launched several times to do that, and they of course never found anything.
Hmm.
But we were all pumped up. We wanted a little air-to-air combat.
That's really bizarre. I've never heard anything like that before. Huh. Interesting. Yeah. So what else about these missions with the Special Forces? Was this what it amounted to for the most part, was just dropping them off and picking them up later?
From the gunship standpoint, yeah, we get called on to actually fire on something, because we weren't supposed to be there.
Right.
And we didn't want to get totally engaged with these people. We'd do anything we could to support them. In fact, we were up there one time. It was during the day before, and it was right on the Cambodian border. I mean, we could have been in Cambodia, but we didn't know. But there was a bunch of sampans, and we were shooting at them. And the gunner suddenly screamed that there was a ceasefire, and there was a blonde-haired guy in one of the sampans.
Hmm.
And so anyway, we came around and started putting fire around it and whatnot, and this guy got out, and turned out he was an American GI. He had been an advisor down the Delta and had been captured and was being moved north, and he was in the sampan, and we started firing in the sampans, and the BC got all excited, and he was able to pop out. They had him covered up. He was able to pop out and wave, and he had blonde hair, fortunately for him.
Hmm.
And we rescued him.
Really?
He was one happy camper.
Do you remember his name?
No.
Huh.
No, but he was happy.
Yeah, I would imagine so. How did the rescue take place?
Well, we were firing on these sampans and the VC. Some of them got killed, and some of them just jumped in the water. And we had 286s. Scout helicopters down, and they went in and picked them up, and we covered them while they did it.
Hmm. That's incredible.
Well, we had died. It was the only POW that we ever had a positive outcome. There was another guy named James Rowe, and he was an Army advisor who had been captured way before I got there, and we constantly had intelligence about him being sighted in the areas in the Delta, and we would launch and never find them. And one time we actually met middle of the night into the found the camp, and the fire was still going. And there was a cage where he had done it, but they had moved them. And then we never, when I was there, we weren't able to find the guy. Well, afterwards, they found him and rescued him. I forgot he'd been something like 5 or 6 years. There's a book about him, an amazing book, and how this guy survived and was rescued and came back home and so forth. And he stayed in the Army. Pulled from the military attaché at the embassy in Manila, and was killed by an assassin after all he'd been through.
I'll be darned.
Yeah.
Isn't that something?
James Rowe, he's got an interesting book.
Okay, we've got Tet's out of the way, and you mentioned you're a little more aggressive in where you're going, your tactics. Take me through the last part here. What sort of things stand out in your mind in terms of missions, in terms of people, in terms of just the war in general? What's going on here? Take me through this last half of your tour.
Well, we ended up doing a lot was we would, like with the Vietnamese, we inserted them in a LZ. They wouldn't move a whole lot usually, so we would break away from them and start looking around in the peripheral areas. And quite often we would find the bad guys, and we would take them under fire, and we did a lot of that, and not even being associated with any ground yet. And that, again, was part of being more aggressive and not politically worrying about what you were supposed to be doing.
Yeah.
And we had a lot of success with that, and so that kind of became the normal mode of operation. Nobody talked about it. I mean, we didn't get any issues or concerns about it, and so that's the way we operated from that point forward, and we were much more effective.
Yeah.
And we didn't really worry too much about it anymore, because before it was such an issue. We were really hamstrung.
Yeah. And obviously a more relief to you, too, I would assume.
Right. A little more. That's your job.
Yeah.
At least you're able to do it without being at one hand tied by anything.
Sure. And you often hear that quite a bit from pilots, or helicopter pilots, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, what is the... You mentioned you're being more aggressive, but what's the pace? Are you picking it up? You got helicopters are being replaced. You've got... pilots and guys who are being replaced as well, are things picking up on that end as well?
Yeah, just from a supply standpoint, and everything started got normalized, and people standpoint, and it got back to normal, and whatever normal was normal. And I went on R&R, and so all that was good.
Where did you go to R&R?
Went to Australia.
Tell me about that. When was this?
That was in May, and went to, you had your choice of where you wanted to go and so forth, and so anyway, I picked Australia, and went to Saigon, and flew on a 707, did a Pan Am 707 to Sydney, and one thing that was interesting is that at that time Australia, they did not, politically, they didn't, didn't want blacks coming in, and they were very open about it. And the Army was very open about it. The black guys, they kind of just tell them, you're probably not going to be welcome there, kind of thing. And they didn't like Asians either. So it was, apparently all white GIs. But anyway, we went there and went to downtown Sydney and stayed there at a hotel, and the Army, of course, they decided what's what. Five days, and we had a good food and got around town. The Australians were very friendly and had a great time and fell in love with Australia.
Yeah. What sort of things did you do and see?
Huh?
I'm sorry. What sort of things did you do and see there?
Just King's Cross, which is downtown Sydney, is kind of their night spot. And we'd go to those and the bars and the sports and the know, the stuff they would do, and we did some sightseeing, and then we're going to the zoo, and boat, and across the harbor there, and it was such a shock going from an environment like Vietnam, and living conditions and everything else, and get off the airplane, and here you are in the real world.
Yeah.
And don't turn the switch overnight, and so there was that element, and, but it was really hard to get back on an airplane.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. What was that like?
Not good. I mean, you had 707 held 150 or so of people, and so you have all these GIs showing up. A lot of them looked hungover. Getting back to the airplane, and 99% of them were asleep before the wheels came up. So we took off, and like I say, everybody was out. And we landed and went across country and landed in Darwin, up on the northwest corner, which was a joint civilian military base. And they said, we're going to be here for an hour and get off. And so anyway, everybody unloaded, and we go up in the equivalent of a terminal where most of them were asleep again. And I happened to notice on the ramp that the crew was out looking up at the rudder on the aircraft. Sorry to announce that the airplane has got a mechanical problem. We're going to be delayed. I've never seen 150 guys come alive so fast. These guys were like, they popped immediately up, going, where are we and what do we do, kind of thing. And the Aussies, because it was a military base there too, the Air Force, next thing you know, they take us over to their side of the base in the middle of the afternoon on a weekday or whatever it was, and they take us into the officers' club and they start a party. That's more than the Aussies can do. And I remember they had go-go girls. I had no idea where they came from, and beer and food. And we were there for two nights and slept. And they gave us quarters. And just a grand old time. And then, then we load up and back to Saga.
Wow.
So we got an extension on our R&R.
You seem to luck into that when you leave the country.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you get back, and it's May of 68. And you don't have that much time. You've got a couple months left in country. I guess we can call you a short timer now.
Yeah.
What does it do to one to be a short timer? You're aware of when your time is up there. Does anything change? Does your attitude change? Does your approach to things change? Does your routine change at all?
Yeah, there was some of that. I can remember just wanting, ready to get out of it, and just wanting to go. And I can remember I remember lying in my bunk one time, and the Vietnamese smoked these raunchy cigarettes, and it smelled horrible. And we were outside the window, and we were, of course, talking with the Vietnamese, and they're smoking these things. And I just I don't want any more of this. And stuff like that, the small things.
Mm-hmm.
But, from a combat standpoint, you're in the back of your head that, end of the wire here, and anything could happen. But then at the end, I mean, the very end, we would just fly at night, do that theoretically. But by then, everything had calmed down a bit, and there wasn't much going on anymore. But we'd keep the gunship over the field at night, and so the short timers would just do the night flights. And so you just go up and fly all night, and then sleep during the day.
Yeah.
And that was pretty benign. And then just looking forward to going home. But I had one hiccup in that I had done that, and I was asleep. And they came running in and woke me up, and they said, we got a mission, you got to go. And it, only two guys on the down that day were, it was a platoon leader and me. And so we jumped in the aircraft, and we said, well, where is it? They said, just head north, and we'll brief you on guard, kind of thing, or and we didn't know what had happened or what, but we knew it was bad. Because we were flying Viking Surprise, that one I mentioned, and the smoke generator and whatnot. And they told us, finally, we got the coordinates to go to, and as we approached it, they said we had some downed aircraft, and they gave us a frequency to talk to, and of the actual site, and we could hear all this gunfire in the background when the guy was talking to us. And they had downed aircraft, and, you know, it was kind of like the Easter Sunday thing prior to that.
Yeah.
And they needed to get the people extracted out of there, and they wanted us to fly the screen up and down. And so we did. And we dropped down to 50 feet and started going back and forth. Well, of course, anybody who had a gun in the world was going to fire at this smoke aircraft. And we did the same thing like Easter Sunday. We just didn't take the hits that they did. And so we fly back and forth, which I didn't like at all, because here we are, I'm due to the home in a couple weeks. Sitting here in Viking Surprise, and as a co-pilot, you had nothing to do. You just sit there, and you couldn't fire back, and you could see all these rounds coming at you, and hitting in the mud in front of you and stuff, and it was a pretty helpless feeling, but I was definitely aware that this is not a good position to be in a couple weeks before you're going home. Anyway, we flew, did it, got the people out, took some hits, but nobody got hurt. That was that, and got out of there.
Am I not being correct here, but were you shot down twice?
Went down twice.
Went down twice?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't believe we talked about the other.
No, we took some rounds, and it was in a gunship, and took the transmission out, the oil filters for the oil filter for the transmission, so we lost transmission oil pressure, but you can't fly a helicopter without transmission. And we were real close to where we had taken the fire and where the activity was, so we just wanted to get we had to get the thing in the ground, so we did. And I was rarely scared in Vietnam, but I was on the ground, it was not my element. And but we landed in the rice paddy, and the drill was that if you went down, you would get the weapons off the aircraft, the crew chief and gunner would get out, get a perimeter set up as best you could, and we'd get out, the pilots would get out, and then we had a 45. And we got behind a dike line, we're in the water up to your neck in the mud, so my wingman was still flying over us, fortunately, and putting fire on us, and as much as he could, and he called for additional help. But it was starting to get dark, and bad guys started coming out of the trees, and so I take this 45, and I hadn't fired it the whole time I'd been there, and shot the thing, and it was like pulling a pebble out of the rice paddy, because these guys all had AK-47s and stuff, and all hell broke loose, and all they did is show them where I was.
Yeah.
And gunners were firing and whatnot, but these guys were coming after us, and and we had had a crew shot down, and we'd gone in and got the bodies, and I'd seen what they did to the bodies, and the pole myself at that time, I don't remember the captain.
What did you see? What did they do?
Well, this was slick, and we got word that an aircraft was missing, and we was a dark the time we got there, and we saw it burning, and we went in, and I remember hovering around with the landing light on, trying to see what was what, and it was too dark, and couldn't really do anything, and so we went back first thing in the morning. You know, the crew had been, two of them had been basically skinned alive, and the others had burned in the crash. And so the guys had been skinned, and they were mutilated. They had died a horrible death.
Wow.
And so at that time, myself, I said, I'm not going to continue. This is no way to go.
And now you find yourself in the middle of a rice paddy.
They hated the gunships too, because we caused them a lot of problems, and so we knew if they got us, we were in trouble. But anyway, these guys were kind of, well, this 45 was worthless, but the other guys were shooting what they had, and that kind of held them back, and then the wingman firing, and by the time we got other aircraft out, and we got extracted, and got out of there, covered in mud and everything, but took the radios and machine guns with us, and then the next day, they actually evacuated the aircraft.
How long were you on the ground?
Well, it seemed like forever, but it wasn't. It was probably an hour or so.
Yeah. What goes through your mind and body in a situation like that? What are you going through?
I was scared, because that's not what you're trained to do. And I wasn't rudimentary trained, but that's not your element.
Yeah, it must have been frightening.
Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah. Okay, well, we got you with a couple weeks left, you know, being shot at here, Viking Surprise. Now, take me through the last couple of weeks. What's the pace of life like for you there in your last couple of weeks?
Well, it definitely slowed down. I mean, we did the night flights, and then you'd be down during the day, and
obviously, you were done with your time there, and you don't want to spend any more time than you have to, I'm sure. But do you reflect on leaving the guys that you've been there with?
Yeah.
What's that like for you?
There was, that part was you're bonded, like you'll never be bonded with anybody else. And that was difficult because you think, well, okay, you're leaving, but they're going to be here. That was just. Got out of there, you know, okay, I'm ready for home.
Mm-hmm. All right, we've got you in Saigon. Pick up the process from there. What do you do in Saigon?
We went to Long Bin, where we come in to the place. Well, that was one thing I failed to mention earlier, is that when I came back from Japan, met a guy up, we were at Long Bin, and we met a guy there who was coming back on his second tour into Vietnam, and flown with the Flextrain Tigers. And we got in the same plane, went back to Flextrain together, and with the Tianto and the Flextrain. And he was a great guy, and he was going to fly in the Vikings. And so even though he was an experienced pilot, he got killed in the attack. Francis Griffin. And he I was flying it down the wing, and we were right by Flextrain Field, and took one round at the aircraft and went. We sat in an armored seat with a plate that slid on the seat and a chicken plate on your chest. And just one round, it came right through the little crack between the two and got him in the heart. He had a family in Alabama and all that, but he was a super guy. But that was when we left Long Bin, and that's where we processed out and got the flight and came home.
Take me on this flight. What is this one like for you?
It was, I don't think I remember doing it sleepy. It's a long flight, but you can endure anything at that point. Just sleeping and just ready to get off and get home. We landed at Travis. And, there were several of us pilots that we got a cab actually in Travis, and we were going to go to San Francisco. And that was surprising because as soon as we came off the base, there were anti-war protesters. And I heard some of that stuff. I didn't dwell on it. Didn't really care about it. But these people were lined up, and women. Young girls, and they had signs up the whole thing, and screaming, and we were dumbfounded. That was a real shock. They hadn't told us anything about that. But so we're in this cab, and they're just going down the road, and every stop sign they were on it. So I got to San Francisco, and I changed. I got.
That must have been quite a shock for you.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
What did you think about these protests and the protesters at this point?
I was repulsed, really, because I mean, you've been through all this and had all these people that, you know, been hurt and died and everything else, and then this is your welcome home. And, yeah, it wasn't good.
Well, why don't we stop there for today, Mr. Kent? This is Kelly Krager continuing an oral history interview with Mr. Barton Kent. Today is 18 June 2015. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Kent is joining me by telephone from his home in Bainbridge Island, Washington. Okay, Mr. Kent, last time we had you coming home. You were in San Francisco. You talked about, you know, seeing the those who were there protesting, and you mentioned that you even took your uniform off. And this was not an uncommon thing for a lot of guys coming back, as I understand it. And oftentimes, I think sometimes they were told by the superiors there to take off their uniform just to avoid any sort of possible confrontation. Mm-hmm. But you get back to Houston. What's it like to be back home from the war? Here it is, 1968. What's it like to be home in that area?
Well, it was good. It was just to get back and live a normal life and see people and decompress, and it was just a transition period, and I didn't take that long in Houston, and I had originally received orders to go back to Fort Walters as an instructor, and then just a week or so before I was coming home, they were changed to like a hunter on the airfield in Georgia, and which was further from home, of course, but I was really interested in going to Savannah and seeing that, the history and so forth of the area, and so I was actually looking forward to that next assignment and ready to get on with it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you come back, here it is, 68, you wind up down at Hunter Army Airfield. Tell me about your time there.
Originally, I was Hunter Stewart, and Hunter being the old Air Force base in Savannah itself, and then Stewart being the large Army base down south of it in the up swamps there of beautiful Georgia. And originally, I was assigned to Fort Stewart and to be a tactics instructor. And Fort Stewart was an old World War II era base, and everything was a wood Splinter Village type accommodations, and I was staying in the BOQ, which was my quarters in Vietnam were actually a little better, and so it was a little bit of a letdown to be around Stewart. In Hinesville, Georgia wasn't much to offer, and so I wasn't real thrilled about all that, but it was just part of it and getting acclimated to the area, and I realized that there wasn't a whole lot to do down that area, so went through the had to wait a period of time to get through the IP school for tactics IP, and got through that and started carrying classes as a tactics instructor. And an opportunity came up where I could get transferred up to Savannah to Hunter, which I jumped on because that's really where I wanted to be. And so I took that and moved up to Savannah and went through a contact IP course. We teach the students how to fly the Huey. And carried classes through there and really enjoyed that. Thoroughly enjoyed Savannah and all the history and whatnot. Did all of that I could. And did civilian flying at a small airport outside of Savannah at Statesboro, Georgia, where Georgia Southern University was. And actually did instructing in airplanes up there with the time off, because we only flew half a day at Hunter, so we had a fair amount of time off. And I would go up there and do that on the weekends or even during the week. So did a lot of flying and saw a lot of the country, saw a lot of the history of the area, and really, really enjoyed it. Savannah is a beautiful city. So, of course, the Vietnam War was still going, and people were coming and going, and Hunter was basically replicated Fort Rucker, because Rucker wasn't able to keep up with the capacity during the peak of the Vietnam War, and Hunter was to fill that in. And then we started getting Vietnamese students in, and which was interesting because, of course, their technical background varied dramatically. Some of them had never even driven a car, and they would send them over to San Antonio to learn English, and then they'd send them to flight school. And I can only imagine how difficult that would be if I was had been sent to Vietnam to learn Vietnamese and then be in a foreign country and trying to learn how to fly. So they varied, their skill levels varied dramatically. So that was an interesting experience, an interesting challenge of trying to teach them. And some of them were very good, and some of them were not so good. But so we had that element that was interjected in with the Americans. And then we also had foreign students from different countries that we would carry through. And then I got transferred to the Flight Standards Division, which we actually trained the CMOI, Contact Methods of Instruction, where we trained the instructor pilots. And we would get them when they came back from Vietnam and then train them to be the instructor pilots. And that was a lot of fun. And actually had an opportunity to do different things. We gave check rides to a lot of the students and other instructors, and we had an opportunity to a couple of the POW, fellows that had been POWs, had been repatriated, and we had the opportunity to fly with them and get them recurrent and stuff, and talk to them about their experiences and stuff. And so that's a little different perspective. There weren't that many Army POWs, and so it was interesting from that standpoint. So we carried on. I had a roommate in an apartment in Savannah, and there was the possibility of being sent back to Vietnam, even though you were going to get out of the Army. And I decided I wanted to get out of the Army. And my roommate actually got sent back to Vietnam, and he was not a happy camper because he was going to get out of the Army, and never really, Tommy, they retrained him and sent him to Vietnam, and Tommy got over there, he never really did any flying because it was a separation time came.
Yeah.
But it was always a hanging over you that you would be going back, and you just accepted it if you had to, but didn't want to. So the war was winding down. I mean, it wasn't over, but it was winding down, and the complexion of it was changing. They were doing the Vietnamization stuff. And then they came in and asked if people were interested in getting out early, about 6 months. And I volunteered for that, and so got out 6 months early, and that was it in Savannah.
I wonder if you might go back a little bit. Your time as an instructor pilot and an instructor of instructors, what sort of things do you take from your Vietnam experience and relate to the students that you're talking to?
Well, when the time I was a tactics instructor, we were teaching them what they were going to do in Vietnam, or trying to best convey what they would be doing in Vietnam. And of course, a lot of that was based on what we did in Vietnam. And we'd try to impart everything we'd learned, both from the textbook and from real life, and let them know what they would be doing and what they would be saying. Of course, we had to follow the instruction program is dictated by the Army, but we also would add to that, embellish it with real life experiences, you know, it was appropriate. So it was, you try to inject as much of the real stuff with into the academic portion of it as you could, without overstepping any bounds. And the students, I think they appreciated that. I know I did when I was going to flight school. And somebody would be able to relate directly what happened in a given scenario versus what theoretically happened. And by and large, the students were good. There were always exceptions, but we were motivated. Even at that point, after all the anti-Vietnam stuff that we had seen at that point, they were still motivated to go and do the job.
Mm-hmm. Now tell me a little bit more about the Vietnamese pilots that you worked with.
Well, like I say, they varied dramatically because, I mean, they had the language. I mean, the majority of them didn't speak English when they came there, so they'd gone through this condensed, crammed language school. And then there's language, and there's English, and then there's aviation. And this, you take somebody who speaks English and throw them into an aviation environment, particularly a learning environment, it's like a different language. You're not going to understand it. So I can only imagine how difficult it was for so many of them. And but they mechanically, some of them were still very good. It was surprising, and they seemed to have a strong will to learn, and the biggest problem was language, because you'd say, okay, we're going to do this, do you understand? Because you didn't want them doing something else, and they would rarely ever say no, because they resist, it wasn't in their character, and then they would try to. They would do what they thought they were supposed to do. Sometimes that wasn't the case. So you had to, as far as an instructor goes, you had to really stay close and watch them so you didn't get in a bad situation. But they were eager students, and they tried very hard. I can't remember a single instance where you had a problem with somebody had a bad attitude or something.
Mm-hmm. Are you following the war very closely once you get back?
I wouldn't say closely. I mean, you'd watch the news, I'd read the Time and the Newsweek or whatever about what was going on. And of course, we talked amongst ourselves a lot because, as people would come back and go through the course, it would be just normal conversation. You'd hear what their take was and what had changed and what was going on where it was headed, and so it was a topic of conversation. And then the social friends you had, I mean, it was within the military. We didn't relate much to the people in the community.
Yeah.
Not necessarily by the design or anything like that. It was just those people, the people that you were had a familiar base with. You tend to communicate with, and that's who we associate with, and not that much from the community. But the city of Savannah, I mean, the town itself, we never saw any of the anti-Vietnam stuff.
Yeah. So when do you officially separate from the Army? You mentioned you got an early out.
Mm-hmm. I got out in January of 70.
January of 70.
Mm-hmm.
All right. What did you hope to do once you left the Army?
Well, I was going back to college, and I literally got out of the Army 1 week, and the next week I entered the University of Houston.
Hmm. And what was your course of study there?
It was business.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a shock. Not a shock, but it was, it was, in a sense that here I just left the military after 4 years, and inner school, and it was like being on another planet because kids in my mind. I wasn't that much older, or if I was any older at all, but you could not relate because this different context altogether. Their priorities and interests and stuff, this was off, was totally different. And that was a cultural shock from that standpoint, adapting. And the thing that really helped was I joined the Texas Guard.
Mm-hmm.
And so that provided an opportunity to be with people with common experiences and socialize with them and have friendships and so forth.
And when did you join the Guard?
As soon as I could. I had applied actually before I got off active duty, so
okay.
You know, the normal drill to get the papers processed and stuff. It was probably that summer before I was actually in the unit, which was out at Ellington Air Force Base in Houston.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would fly. I was instructing part-time at a hobby airport in airplanes, and then going to school and then flying in the Guard. We were getting the first Hueys that the National Guard got. We were an airborne brigade. That was an experimental thing, part of a roundout unit for the 82nd Airborne at Fort Bragg. And it was the only National Guard airborne unit, brigade. And so we got the first Hueys the Guard got. And so a lot of the guys that were in the unit prior to that were, they were really old. They were Korean War guys. The Vietnam guys, like me, were just starting to get into the unit. So we would, we got the first three Hueys the Guard got, and check people out in those and so forth. But the Guard was a lot of fun. I mean, it was like a flying, but you got paid as like a fraternity almost, and you look forward to the weekends and the other stuff that would come up, and it wasn't, at that point in time, the Army didn't look upon the Guard as anything very serious, and it was like a big fraternity almost.
Mm.
And we really, I mean, I really enjoyed it. We flew all over the state, I had to take a Huey by myself and just go fly, nobody cared where you went, and you could do just about anything you wanted.
Yeah.
But, and it changed. Obviously, it's changed dramatically
sure.
over the years, but it was back then. It was a totally different experience.
Yeah. Well, as the war continues to kind of grind on and then wind down, of course, you know, you're in college, you're pursuing a business degree in the National Guard, Texas National Guard. What about the early 1973, the Paris Peace Accords are signed and the U.S. agrees to remove all of its troops? What do you remember about that? What are your feelings on that?
There was a sense that, among all of us, I think, that, it was no surprise. I mean, everybody felt that it was headed in that direction, I think. And it was good just to get rid of it, get out of there and be done with it, because we surely weren't pursuing it aggressively, and we weren't pursuing it militarily the way it should have been. It was mixed emotions. You felt like it was a defeat. But then you felt, okay, this is a curse of the country, then so be it, and let's get on with something else. And it put it in the rearview mirror. So, yeah, there was mixed emotions.
Yeah. Okay, let me take it to the next step. What about the fall of Saigon? Do you remember when that happened?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
what
that,
were your thoughts,
I mean,
on that?
That was just felt it was pathetic, you know. I mean, it's a combination of it was bound to happen because we weren't supporting the Vietnamese, and then the Vietnamese, a lot of them, we felt, you know, didn't have the will to fight anyway. And so when it happened, it wasn't any surprise, and again just reinforcing that the sense that we failed. Wasn't done right, and all that effort and all that lives and money and everything else was wasted.
When did you finish up your degree at the University of Houston?
Well, I actually ended up getting hired by the Texas Guard. Again, like I mentioned, we were getting new aircraft from the Hueys, and then we were getting new, brand new H-58s from Bell Helicopter. And the fellow that ran the unit in San Antonio had been in my company in Vietnam, actually, and prior to me being there. Good old Texas Aggie. And he asked me to go to work there as a DS-12 flight instructor full time. And so my goal was to fly professionally once I finished college. And and so this was an opportunity to fly and whatnot. And so I went ahead and did that, moved to San Antonio, and became a full-time flight instructor for the Guard. So we flew airplanes and helicopters and whatnot, and the Guard was growing then, as I mentioned, and getting new equipment and becoming more of a viable force. And the most fulfilling thing was helping out during disasters. We had hurricanes or whatever, big storms, and we would go out and help people. And that was really the best part of it. And we did that fairly often, actually. And so I enjoyed that for a period of time. And I was going to night school in San Antonio. Actually finished up my degree there in business. So I did that for about 5 years, I guess. Yeah, about 5 years.
So you stayed with the Guard for 5 years, is that what you said?
Well, full time.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Full time?
Yeah.
Okay. So that would have taken you to what, like 75, I guess it would have been?
Right.
75, 76 in that time frame. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, now, do you stay in the National Guard part-time after this?
Yeah, well, at that point in time, I was getting one of the fellows in the unit worked for a company called Hughes Helicopters. It was Howard Hughes, one of his entities, and built helicopters, built the OH-6 for Vietnam, the TH-55 that was up at Mineral Wells for training, and then had a commercial line. And anyway, he was a marketing guy down in Texas region, down in the central region of the United States, and he'd sold a helicopter, and if the fellow was looking for somebody to fly for him, he had airplanes and helicopters, and I actually went and did that. That was back in Houston, and flew corporately for 3 years, and stayed in the Texas Guard part-time during that period of time, flying. And after about 3 years there, I actually got offered a job at Hughes Helicopters as a sales manager for selling helicopters. And so I did that, and it became the rest of my career. I spent the rest of my time in sales and marketing with helicopters.
Interesting.
And moved to California, became a regional sales manager, and sold helicopters and civilian helicopters and for Hughes Helicopters. And then Hughes Helicopters was bought by McDonnell Douglas in 84. And by then I was a division marketing manager, had regional sales managers working for me, and I had the West Coast and so forth. And then McDonnell Douglas bought the company, and they invested in it, and we were pursuing, we had won the Apache contract from the Army, which was a godsend for Hughes, because the company really needed that, and that's the reason McDonnell Douglas bought the company. And so we had a commercial product line, a military line, and McDonnell Douglas built the brand new factory in Mesa, Arizona, and we were in Culver City, California, with Hughes, where Howard Hughes had built the Spruce Goose and all that. And then McDonnell built the company over in the factory over in Mesa, moved everybody there. And I went into international marketing and had an office in Singapore, and then covered that part of Asia, and then ended up being the area manager for all of Asia for McDonnell Douglas, and off in Canberra and Hong Kong and Tokyo and Seoul. And spent my whole life on airplanes bouncing around Asia for 5 years, and then came back, and I managed both North and South America for the company, and selling both military and commercial helicopters, and did that for another 4 years, so I spent 9 years overseas. And got to do a lot of quality traveling.
Yeah, sounds like it.
And saw a lot of the world and all that, and we sold both the military and commercial, and met some really interesting people, and sold helicopters to generals and to everybody from Bill Gates to the guy trying to make a buck with a helicopter, and fleet owners like Petroleum Helicopters down the Gulf of Mexico and so forth. So anyway, it was a great career from that standpoint. Met tons of interesting people and saw a lot of interesting things, and spent a lot of time in China. And so the Army, from that standpoint, gave me an opportunity for a really interesting career.
Yeah, sounds like it.
And then I was going to retire, and then I got recruited by American Eurocopter, which is headquartered down in Grand Prairie, and Franco-German manufacturer, and actually worked for them for 7 years, doing sales.
Well, I've got just a couple of last questions for you, Mr. Kent, and they're, you know, for you to open for interpretation to answer however you see fit, because they're mm-hmm. kind of broad-ranging questions. The first is, you're looking back on your time in the military, and especially your time in Vietnam. How do you think those experiences most affected your life?
Well, it was a maturing period, obviously. The flying aspect of it, from a pure flying standpoint, is removing it from what you were doing. I mean, it was not an experience that you couldn't gain anywhere else. And so, from the pure flying standpoint, it was very enriching. The relationships that you formed at that point in your life when you were very young. You don't realize it at the time, but then as you grow older, of course, you realize that those are relationships that you never would experience anywhere else. And they really don't go away, because like today we have this unit that we get together once a year, and everybody's like a kid again. And it's amazing what everybody remembers, and it's like everything was yesterday. So there, that period of time was very... very, very compressed, and it was very it made more impact on you than you ever realized when you were there, or even when you were younger, but you realize later, and both good and bad, but it doesn't leave. And so from that standpoint, it was a major life event. But the Army as a whole, like I said, it opened the door and turned something I enjoyed into a career for the rest of my life, a very fulfilling career and enriching career. And so that was good. So if I had to do all over again, I'd probably do the same thing.
My last question for you is another kind of broad one. We're looking at almost 50 years from your time in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. Closing in on 50 years. Sorry to break that bad news to you, but it is the truth. And Vietnam has come to mean a lot of things in the United States. The war, that is.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think is the lasting historical legacy or significance of Vietnam? When we say the Vietnam War, what do you think it means in the larger sense?
Well, hopefully it was a learning experience for the country, which I think is still debatable, because it's interesting, because here where I live in Bainbridge Island, there's a fellow here I met who he's French, but has lived here in the United States for many, many years. But he was in the French Navy when he was 16 in Vietnam, and he spent almost two years there, and was at Dien Bien Phu when the French fell and were kicked out. And as he talked and related what the French did, it was so interesting, because we did almost the same exact things, and which were wrong. And we obviously didn't learn from the French, because we just made the same foolish mistakes as a country. And you look at subsequent events as we participated in Iraq, of course, and Afghanistan most recently, but it again, it's just we seem to go down, we not have learned from past engagements where there were mistakes, and that's disappointing, because, you know, people sacrifice and we should be able to learn from those. And a lot of us don't feel like we have. And we continually make mistakes internationally and commit resources and people and to these events that are not well-founded. And that's the greatest disappointment, I would think.
Well, Mr. Kent, is there anything else you'd like to add to the interview before we bring it to a close?
No, like I say, I'll gather the stuff I have, and I got Anna's email information, and I'll be sending it on for what it's worth, and for everything I hear, you do a great job there.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Well, okay, we'll go ahead and bring an official close to the interview then.